with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, July 16th, 2026. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Robert Kuttner, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect and author of Notes for Next Time, Surviving Tyranny, Redeeming America, joins Sam, who recorded this conversation a little earlier, to discuss how Democrats embraced neoliberalism. Also on the program, 103 Democrats and one Republican, Thomas Massie, vote to block over $3 billion in State Department aid to Israel. The Pentagon says it's looking at military options against Cuba, including thousands of U.S. troops. When has that gone wrong, Matt? History buff? By the way, U.S. military resources are very strained in Iran right now, so good luck. Trump is apparently unhappy with Hegseth over how the Iran war is going. You'll be shocked to hear that Hegseth was the most hawkish voice, selling him on the efficacy of military action, overriding the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
So boring. Just wrap it up. God.
Iran says the U.S. launched an attack near a children's cancer hospital, causing evacuations, and that the U.S. is bombing closer to Tehran than ever before. Israel is also bombing Gaza again, killing at least five people overnight, including a little girl. A new ACLU and Human Rights Watch report on the East Montana ICE camp in Texas finds 90% of detainees report beatings and abuse. And in a Georgia facility, a Venezuelan man, 45-year-old Jesus Manuel Arena Silva, becomes the 22nd person to die in ICE custody this year. Trump is giving a speech tonight claiming that there was all this Chinese interference in the 2020 election, apparently. The stuff that everybody cares about. And speaking of China, there's a new Pew Global survey that finds that China is viewed more favorably than the United States. Why could that be? Todd Blanche had an incredible Freudian slip during his attorney general confirmation hearings, calling himself Trump's lawyer before quickly correcting himself. And lastly, air quality warnings hit 20 states as smoke from the Canadian wildfires spreads to the U.S. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's an Majority Report Thursday. We've been getting some concerns about where Sam is. He's fine. He's fine. He will be back eventually, but this will probably be his longest absence from the Majority Report in quite some time. He is doing Hollywood things. I'm not sure we can reveal what he's doing, but he's filming something. That's okay to say? Okay.
That is grandma.
And that is grandma. I can't wait to play that for him and him be completely confused by it, unless he's seen the segment and is watching the show, which, you know, hopefully he's not, because we've been making fun of him.
I think
constantly.
He does make a point to make sure to watch all of our PBD related content when he's out.
The most educational content that we put out. Yes. So yesterday there were many hearings on Capitol Hill. It was a busy day. You had Todd Blanche's attorney general confirmation hearing, which is kind of a bit of kayfabe, like he cannot get confirmed and Trump's just going to keep him as acting attorney general for the foreseeable future, most likely. But we'll play maybe a clip in the fun half of Senator Kennedy like throwing up a softball for him and asking Blanche if he was Trump's friend. And he responded, "I'm Trump's lawyer." And I was Trump's lawyer. You know, the guy that personally spoke to Ghislaine Maxwell and then transferred her to that cushy prison outside of traditional protocol for sex offenders. And suddenly she was very quiet about Trump's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh, is that part of the communications mistakes that were made, as J.D. Vance admitted on Joe Rogan? Oh, yeah, we made some mistakes in terms of how we communicit. I mean, like, communicating the sentence of Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yes, right. Communicating to her to keep quiet.
Yeah. It's a go walker dog in this, like, open-air prison.
Yep. Then we have the Fed chair testimony as well with the Senate Banking Committee. But what is really going viral here, excuse me, I need to take a sip of water. The air quality is really bad.
Yeah, it's crazy brutal here. I don't know, people, actually it's around the whole Northeast. awful.
Yeah. So there was the Senate Intelligence Committee hearings for Trump's pick for the Director of National Intelligence, replacing Tulsi Gabbard. When Tulsi Gabbard stepped aside, basically, Bill Pulte became acting DNI, and he is from, like, a real estate background. He has no national intelligence experience. And so this pick here was considered to be less controversial, Jay Clayton, because he had worked at Sullivan and Cromwell. What is their association with the deep state, by the way?
I mean, I think going back to like the Panama Canal.
Exactly.
Like, creation.
There is not a law firm that is more synonymous with like U.S. intervention overseas. Mm. And I mean, Banana Republic and the Dulles brothers, right. So he's actually quite perfect for the deep state. And he
type of things that they have in their archives would be very interesting to
very interesting
browse through.
But he was considered less controversial. He was a respected lawyer, basically, as opposed to just a 38-year-old real estate buddy from Florida who was the acting head of the acting director of national intelligence. And yet, despite his so-called respectability and his so-called lack of controversy as it relates to other Trump nominees, he still cannot answer the central question, the test of your independence. Did Trump win the 2020 election? Who won the 2020 election? And John Ossoff, senator from Georgia, just nails him here on this question and doesn't let up. Here is this moment yesterday from those hearings.
2020 election.
You know, I'm not going to do this with you.
This is a job interview. We've established that you have an obligation to be honest and forthright with the committee. Yes, you do have an obligation to be honest and forthright with the committee.
Yes.
Who won the 2020 election?
Like I said, I'm not going to get into that with you.
But you do have an obligation to be honest and forthright with the committee.
Is anything that I just said not honest or forthright?
Yes, you're not being honest or forthright. Who won the 2020 election?
I think I've answered the question. We can keep doing this.
Well, we're going to keep doing it because you're not being honest and forthright.
No, I'm not going to engage in the theater.
It's a simple question, Mr. Clayton.
And I've answered.
Who won the 2020 presidential election?
I've answered it.
You're here asking for the support of senators to lead America's intelligence community. We've established that you have an obligation to be honest and forthright with this committee and with the American public, but you refuse to answer a simple matter of fact about the 2020 election. Is that right?
No, that's not right.
Then answer the question. Who won the 2020 election?
I have answered the question.
Answer it. What is your answer?
I've given you my answer.
What is your answer? You refuse to answer a basic question about who won a presidential election?
No,
but you asked to lead America's intelligence community? Isn't it humiliating to be unable to answer this question, to have to indulge the president's delusions? We know, you know, everybody in this room knows the truthful answer to that question. Why can you not give it?
I think I gave you the answer.
Are you aware that Director Gabbard was present at the Fulton County raid in Georgia earlier this year?
All right, let's pause it for a second. We'll go back to that clip because it's also the next one that I wanted to hit on. Ossoff's whole testimony here, or questioning rather, was quite effective. It's just a simple test of your ability to not be a loyalist for Donald Trump and do your job faithfully. The problem is that you are he's literally being selected with that being the number one job requirement. And it's when Ossoff here asked him about Tulsi Gabbard, this is also relevant for the reasons that I just said. Because earlier this year, Tulsi Gabbard, who was at the time the director of national intelligence, was present at this FBI raid in Georgia of the Fulton County voter rolls at this, or at the elections office. She was the director of national intelligence. It's one, it's not a domestic law enforcement agency, but two, the implication of her presence at that raid would be that this has something to do with foreign interference. And so with Trump's address tonight, where he's going to blame Chinese interference on, you know, him on the 2020 election results, and is seemingly going to draw that comparison, essentially, to claim that China is the reason that, I don't know, the votes were switched. I will see what he has to say.
That we're not going to Ossoff got enough.
Right, right. He's also claiming that they're illegitimate. This is quite relevant because it appears like the director of national intelligence, whoever, you know, if Clayton is confirmed, is going to be involved in this completely nonsense investigation into Georgia's election results from 2020 that are the result of the delusions that he speaks about there. So it's quite relevant here. And here's the continuation of that questioning.
Director Gabbard was present at the Fulton County raid in Georgia earlier this year.
You discussed that with me yesterday in your office.
Are you aware that Director Gabbard was present at the Fulton County raid earlier this year?
You brought it to me, my attention.
What is going on here? You've said at the beginning of this you have an obligation to be honest and forthright with the committee. I'm asking a very simple question. Are you aware that Director Gabbard was present?
What we're about to see now is however old man, what, 60, this guy, about to act cute.
Oh, yeah.
With the committee, I'm asking a very simple question. Are you aware that Director Gabbard was present at the Fulton County raid earlier this year? Yes or no? Are you aware?
I was.
You won't answer that question either.
I just said I was made aware of it by you yesterday.
The first time you learned that Director Gabbard was present at that raid was in my office yesterday?
It was the first time that in my recollection I've thought about it recently. Was I aware of it before?
What?
What the
first time in my recollection I thought about it recently. I can't rule out the fact that I have had amnesia about the reports of the predecessor for the job that I'm trying to take over being present at the raid of Georgia's election offices.
He can't admit that he knows about it, but also if he admits that he doesn't know about it, it's like, why are you not competent to lead this,
exactly,
lead this office?
He's like, I just don't pay attention to the news. You know, I'm nonpartisan. I'm more interested in baseball cards.
I'll lock in when I get the job.
Right. How hard can it be to learn all about politics? I'll cram it. Keep going. Yeah.
You brought it to me.
What's going on here? You've said at the beginning of this you have an obligation to be honest and forthright with the committee. I'm asking a very simple question. Are you aware that Director Gabbard was present at the Fulton County raid earlier this year? Yes or no? Are you aware?
I was.
You won't answer that question either.
I just said I was made aware of it by you yesterday.
The first time you learned that Director Gabbard was present at that raid was in my office yesterday?
It was the first time that in my recollection I've thought about it recently. Now, was I aware of it before?
What?
I really appreciate that. What?
Yeah.
What?
You brought it to my attention yesterday.
Okay.
I had not.
So you had not known.
I had not thought about it until you brought it to my
thought
attention.
Thought about
your
it.
Your answers lack credibility. Your testimony lacks credibility. You're being evasive and you're not being candid or forthright. And everybody across the country is going to watch this and know that. Are you aware that former Director Gabbard testified that her presence at the raid was, quote, requested by the president.
He's trying to phone the same trap.
I'm not aware of that until now.
Okay, you are now aware of that.
Yeah.
Are you aware that members of this committee are already probing Director Gavritt's potential misconduct in this matter?
I'm not privy to
have Wi-Fi.
Are you aware that the General Counsel and Deputy General Counsel of your office have already provided testimony to this committee regarding this matter?
You told me that.
If the White House Chief of Staff or the President asks you to travel somewhere across the United States and oversee the execution of a domestic search warrant on a sensitive election facility, will you do it? Is that appropriate for the Director of National Intelligence?
That's a hypothetical.
We all know it's not appropriate.
Senator Ossoff, your time
of National Intelligence, will you answer the question?
Your time is
hypothetically, is it appropriate?
All right. Will you give him the opportunity to answer the question? Is this not material right now, sir? Is it appropriate for the Director of National Intelligence to oversee the execution of domestic search warrants at sensitive election facilities? Yes or no?
I think you're asking me, as you just said in your first comment to me.
Yes or no, is it appropriate? No.
You are asking me to comment on a matter that you just said was under investigation.
No, I'm asking you.
Okay, Senator Ossoff, your time is expired.
Disqualified.
Vice Chairman, do you have anything to add?
Well, Ossoff made the most of his time there. You would think that an esteemed lawyer from Sullivan and Cromwell would be a little bit better in this cross-examination, because we looked this up before the show. Ossoff is not a lawyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, Ossoff just schooled him in cross-examination.
It's crazy to be from Sullivan and Cromwell, and that's like me if I got home late, and it's like...
Right.
You said 10 o'clock. It's 10:20.
Yeah.
Their clock said it was earlier. So.
It's astonishing. The Director of National Intelligence, this is a role that has, increased in prominence since the turn of the 21st century as well. But prior to that, it's more when the powers of the executive branch have been expanded. The Director of National Intelligence has also expanded in its powers. And it's a shadowy role that is certainly not supposed to be involved in on-the-ground domestic law enforcement operations, unless this is some sort of conspiracy to undermine our electoral process. And that's what's happening right now. And so it doesn't necessarily matter what your resume is, or the fact that you may have some New York lawyer friends that think that you're a smart guy. It matters what the job requirements are and what is being asked of you or demanded of you by this administration. And we know that this is essentially a test of loyalty about, well, one, the fact that senators are asking this of judicial nominees is relevant as well, because it's a test of their loyalty. But specifically about this case,
yeah, given, will you help us steal an election?
Yes.
In the future?
Given what Tulsi Gabbard was tasked with doing, Trump is going to task the next Director of National Intelligence with the same thing. And she was kind of thrown under the bus by Todd Blanche, who, as acting Attorney General, because she was unable to, according to some reporting, after commissioning reports on the election results, come up with the answers that Trump wanted. And then she's out. You know, do you think that Clayton learned that lesson? Do you think that he knows that if he doesn't deliver on the president's delusions, as Ossoff said, that he'll be out of a job next? That is the lesson that is being sent as Trump operates like a mafia boss. So it's horrifying stuff. And so, you know, that's essentially where we're at here.
Yeah, a bunch of liars. And Trump's about to say some lies about China meddling in the election process, which they did not do. At all.
No.
Meanwhile, Trump and our State Department, in fact, is giving money to MAGA-aligned groups in Eastern Europe, just openly.
Right.
Imagine if China was doing that.
Well, now we're going to talk about a country that's actually interfering in our elections really briefly.
Oh, I wonder which one you're talking about.
This interview with Robert Kuttner. So just wanted to make sure we got this also in the first hour of the show, because this is such an important story. Let's see. So yesterday, Thomas Massey, the Republican who was just ousted by record spending in a congressional House primary, beating Jamal Bowman's race and Cori Bush's race, with AIPAC pouring in as much money as possible into his primary, he lost. And he's the only Republican who voted for his own measure here. This amendment that Massey proposed would have halted around $3.3 billion in aid to Israel that would have gone through the State Department. It's the fiscal 2027 funding bill. And this amendment proposed a prohibition on funds from this bill to being used by Israel. And the bulk of this money, of course, it's the foreign military financing program, goes to Israel. So as I mentioned, Massey was the only Republican to vote for his own amendment. But 103 Democrats voted with him as well. Now, it was obviously rejected. That's not enough. 104 to 314. So that's 103 Democrats plus Massey. And 10 Democrats, cowardly Democrats, voted present. So when you take that math, though, that's 103 Democrats out of 212 in the caucus and 10 voted present. So that's a very narrow plurality, essentially, of Democrats who voted yes, we need to block arms to Israel. In April 2024, only 37 Democrats voted to block arms to Israel. And at the time, of course, it's like, you know, the usual suspects of good progressives were, you know, had Kassar, Bowman and Bush at the time, Tlaib, AOC, Raskin, Velasquez, Becca Belint, and more. You know, I don't need to list all of them. You probably know who some of them are. Jayapal, Khanna. So those were the Democrats that the 37 in April 2024 who voted to block arms. And you see, just like we saw with the Senate vote on Bernie Sanders' bill to block large bombs and bulldozers to Israel, how the Democratic Party is slowly responding to the sea change in the electorate and in the base on arms to Israel. And the 103 Democrats who voted for this amendment have some surprising names in it. Jake Auchincloss. Isn't that shocking, Matt? Catherine Clark, the number two Democrat in the House Minority Whip. Seth Moulton, who is as hawkish as it gets, but he's trying to defeat Ed Markey in the primary right now. And one mama bear, Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi has...
That is grandma.
That's good. There's never been a more appropriate use of that is grandma. Because, like... She's a ruthless tactician, and it was often for things that we really, really disagreed with. But unlike Hakeem Jeffries, she understands politics and was really good at keeping the caucus together and whipping votes and doing politics, even when it was about defeating the left within her own party. But she also can see where the winds are blowing. This is what she said 7 years ago. And just yesterday, Nancy Pelosi voted against $3 billion in arms to Israel.
I have said to people when they ask me if this Capitol crumbled to the ground, the one thing that would remain is our commitment to our aid. And I don't even call it aid, our cooperation with Israel. That's fundamental to who we, fundamental to.
Insane.
Turns out, not so much. Capitol's still standing, despite the attempts of the January Sixers. And you, what's interesting is seeing Chuck Schumer sitting next to her grinning, by the way, as she says that.
Well, I've heard through like the theory of force the vote that if somebody votes for something, it means they definitely truly want that thing to come true, right? So this means Pelosi's an anti-Zionist now?
I guess so.
Sure.
I guess so. It just is an indication of where things are. And
where voters are.
Yep.
This is such a liability. Like, to, oh, Detroit or Michigan, though. Haley Stevens voted, I wouldn't just note, was not one of these 100 that voted.
Was not. It. Exactly right. Haley Stevens, captured by AIPAC, voted to continue sending arms to fund this genocidal rogue state. Here's the Washington Post's write-up with some charts about where Democrats are on this development. A number of Democrats who have voiced support for Israel voted for the amendment, including former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Catherine Clark, the minority whip. We can put this up on the screen. In a statement, Clark, the number two House Democrat, said the status quo is not tenable. She added, we should not provide a blank check for military aid to any country that does not comply with U.S. law, interests, and values. The Netanyahu government has failed to meet that standard. Public support for Israel has plummeted over the country's military campaigns in Gaza and Lebanon, particularly among Democrats. Nearly three quarters of Democrats want to reduce or end military support for Israel, according to a Washington Post Ipsos poll conducted July 8th to 13th. 40% of Democrats want to eliminate military support to Israel entirely, including 58% of very liberal Democrats. And you can see this chart here from the Washington Post where voters are. Republicans, still a majority of them, support maintaining or increasing support for Israel.
Only 13% of them, even those psychos.
Yeah. But for the Democrats, in terms of keeping at current levels and increasing, like, what is that? 24.
Yeah.
But when you add ending military support and reducing support, that is 74%. And still, it's only half of the caucus. They're not where their own voters are.
But Hakeem Jeffries tells me there's good faith reasons why Democrats might disagree on this stuff. And why. So, of course, those 25%, they have good faith reasons that we must respect.
And check out this chart right below it, because this also shows temporally how things have changed. The share of registered voters saying the U.S. is too supportive of Israel from January 2017 to now. You can see that... obviously dramatically increase in terms of the total support there,
including
based on age. Yeah,
the Republicans have started hating Israel as Trump's got into office.
Right. That top line there for 74% are Democrats, leaning Democrats age 18 to 49. 74% say that the U.S. is too supportive of Israel. And Democrats and Democrat leaners 50 and over, 64%. So there's, I mean, within Democratic voters or Democratic leaning voters, that is the consensus opinion at this point. The Democrats that voted against cutting aid to Israel, Matt mentioned it. Haley Stevens was one of those individuals. Hakeem Jeffries was one of those individuals as leader of the Democrats in the House. And there's still a long way to go, but this is a reminder that we should always continue to push. Always push. Call your representatives. It makes a difference. Change is not easy, and it is way too sclerotic and slow, but it is making an impact. And it should also be a lesson for people who have been overly swayed by Republican-aligned influencers on the internet talking about Israel, that the political constituency that can actually change things is the one where that is on the Democratic side, and it's the side that supports universal human rights, not saying the Democratic Party does, but the voters that support this and have that as an ethic versus the isolationism on the right that doesn't have really right now any power base within the elected Republican Party. So Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens and Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's now essentially an influencer herself, can go out on podcasts and say what they feel. That's great. But for right now, the Republican Party is in lockstep with Israel, save for Thomas Massie, who is about to be out of office right now. The path to ending support for Israel is going to go through the Democratic Party because of the voters, not because of the representatives, but because that is what the voters are going to continue to demand. And it's not going to get any quieter. That's why Netanyahu and the Israeli government is so desperate right now to maintain support amongst Republicans, because they already see that the die is cast. And they're attempting to permanently, essentially, integrate the U.S. and Israeli militaries so that this question is not able to be answered democratically.
And I would just add, a house divided cannot stand. And if the Democratic leadership treats this like not something to be welcomed, but something to be fought against, it will destroy the party.
Exactly right. In a moment, you will hear Sam's interview with Robert Kuttner. But first, a word from one of our favorite sponsors. I would like to thank ZocDoc for sponsoring today's episode. ZocDoc, we've talked about this many times, is a one of like the easiest services that I can think of in terms of being able to use it for free. You could just go online to go to ZocDoc, find appointments for a doctor that you need. And you can see the calendar and their schedule. You don't have to deal with automated, you know, systems when you're calling into your doctor's office. And, oh, why is it closed on a Monday for some reason? You can't reach them. You're playing phone tag. You have to deal with a bunch of different people or just robots on the phone. ZocDoc takes away that hassle, and it makes it easier for you to book doctor's appointments that you may have been putting off. I found my dentist through ZocDoc. I really like my dentist. So that means that I'm going fairly regularly, which is good. And so I just couldn't recommend it more highly. ZocDoc really solves the most frustrating parts of the patient experience. And say you have an emergency like Sam did with one of his crowns, he was able to find a dentist on the other side of the country. ZocDoc is free to use. They have more than 150,000 providers with 200-plus specialties across all 50 states. And you're able to find someone if you want to filter by your insurance or if you want to filter by specialty. ZocDoc makes that easy with its searchable system. Your health matters, and taking care of yourself shouldn't be complicated. Find and book the right doctor with ZocDoc. Head to ZocDoc.com/majority to get started and check that appointment off your to-do list. That's ZocDoc.com/majority. ZocDoc.com/majority. We'll put a link to this down below in the video and episode descriptions. Find and book the right doctor at ZocDoc.com/majority. All right, quick break. And when we come back, you'll be hearing Sam's interview with Robert Kuttner.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Bob Kuttner. Robert Kuttner is the co-founder and current editor of The American Prospect. In 1986, Kuttner founded the Economic Policy Institute, currently serves on its executive committee. Kuttner, in addition to many other jobs in the media, also served in on the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, and author of now his 14th book, which is a memoir, Notes for Next Time, which is, I have to say, incredibly appropriate for this very moment. Bob Kuttner, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And let me just also just like say, you know, this is a memoir, but one which really is a way in which to travel through American politics over the some odd 50 years plus that you have been either writing about or directly involved. I watched your interview with David Dayen, which folks can find on the American Prospect YouTube channel, which covered a lot of the sort of more personal aspects from your story. We'll touch on that a little bit, but I can't encourage people enough to go over to the American Prospect YouTube page and listen, because really just a
fascinating life in the context of politics. One of my favorite stories was how you almost inadvertently joined the CIA or became a, but I will leave that for a moment. Let's start back, because for me, one of the things I want to focus on is the your lessons from working on these committees in the Senate, because we're about to enter into a period where I think we're going to have a lot of hearings by Democrats. It would be wonderful they take the Senate, but at the very least, we're going to see it in the House. But before we get there, let's just talk just a little bit about your life. You grew up, was it in Brooklyn or the Bronx?
Well, I was born in the Bronx.
Born in the Bronx. Ultimately, your family moved to Scarsdale. Your father passed away when you were quite young. And you developed, I mean, a real, I guess, appreciation, a lived appreciation for the New Deal that was prominent in that era. Just briefly tell us a little bit about that, as it, I think it sets the tone for your politics.
Frozen. Shall I just keep talking?
Yeah, go ahead. Did you hear my question?
I did, yeah.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Let me just take a moment to locate that origin story, if you will, in the context of the sweep of what I'm trying to do in the book, because it's directly related. One of the three key points I make in the book is that the deal that my generation had was a better social contract, if you will, than anything that has been offered before or since. And that we lost it. I talk about why we lost it, and I talk about how we might get it back. And the punchline is it will take a politics and a set of policies at least as radical as what FDR gave us to get anything like the social contract that my generation had back for our children and grandchildren. And I grew up moderate income housing project in the Bronx called Parkchester. And, you know, my parents thought they had died and gone to heaven. They spent the Depression, very rough time, in a series of small cramped apartments in Queens. And Parkchester was developed with tax abatements and public subsidies. And then when my father got sick, I was 8 years old. My mother and I began having very adult conversations, what would happen if he died. And he was getting wonderful medical care thanks to the new VA hospital. And my mother said, no, we won't lose the house because of something called Social Security. And when you put together Social Security, built with government help, and the VA, and Parkchester, Social Security, Parkchester, the VA, as I say in the book, I was a New Dealer in my bones before I'd ever heard of FDR, because my lived experience was that of a package of things that helped my family stay in the kind of lower middle class. And then, of course, being a poor kid in a rich town, my parents and my grandfather had bought a little 900 square foot house just inside the Scarsdale line so that I could attend a good school. And being around rich kids as a kid from a family with no money, that also honed my sense of social class. And then I went to Oberlin in the sort of hopeful part of the 60s. So all of this kind of formed my politics. But I think that was a very hopeful time. And I guess one of the things I try to explore via my own life odyssey is how could we have had such a good deal for most working people, and then how did we lose it? What did the Democratic Party do wrong, beginning with Carter and Clinton and then Obama, and the influence of the corporate Democrats, the Wall Street Democrats, Robert Rubin, in really screwing it up and getting in bed with Wall Street, to the point where working families no longer saw the Democratic Party as their champion, and that began the road to Trump. What happened? How do we get that back? And that's a lot of what I talk about. And I'll get to Senator Proxmire and the Banking Committee in a moment, if you like.
Yes, I would. I'm really interested in that and the implications of the things that you worked on and how they resonated. But let's talk a little bit about, you know, just a little bit more about your life in terms of how it gave you this perspective on what the Democrats did wrong, because you were also a journalist for a long time, and it led you ultimately. I mean, following your stint with Proxmire, you set up the Economic Policy Institute, or were one of the three founders, and then you also went on to co-found the American Prospect. So you had an awareness of both, like, what needed to happen on a policy level, but also what needed to happen on a journalistic level in terms of sort of right that ship. But from your perspective as a journalist prior to that, what was it that, and I guess also in terms of your government service, how did that turn happen? Like what created, because for, you know, we had a 30-year Democratic majority in the House. In the 50s and 60s, we had a 90% top tax rate for people making over approximately $470,000 at that time, maybe close to $3 million today. How did we lose sight as a country of what was working? Because that was, I mean, obviously we needed to emancipate women. We needed to emancipate Black people. We needed to move in. You know, in terms of the social emancipation, but how did we get, how did we lose in that process, providing materially for our people?
So that's a lot of what the book talks about. And I was involved in this both as a protagonist and as a journalist. So it's a tragedy in three acts, right? So act one is Johnson and the war. So Johnson has a majority almost as big as FDR's. And if you go back to 1964, Johnson wins in a landslide. He has almost 2-to-1 majorities in Congress, and he is poised to launch the unfinished business of the New Deal. And the attempt to extend American democracy to Black people would have been a heavy lift in any case. But he sets out on that road very heroically. And then, of course, he blows it all on Vietnam. And the tragedy of Vietnam is not just that it distracted attention from the unfinished business of the New Deal, but that it split the Democratic coalition, both politically and culturally, the hippies and the hard hats, and lets Nixon become president. And the Democratic coalition, in a sense, never really recovers from that catastrophe. So that's act one of the tragedy. Then, a miracle of miracles, Nixon blows it all on Watergate. And one of the things I did in my journalistic life, I was part of the Watergate team at the Washington Post. I had a front row seat for that. And miracle of miracles, not only does Nixon get impeached and is forced to leave office, but 1976, we elect a Democratic president, and Jimmy Carter, thanks to the Watergate Congress, has a very big working majority. Oh boy, here we get a do-over. When does history ever give you a do-over? But Carter turns out to be the most conservative Democrat since Grover Cleveland. He's sort of a process liberal, despite having a big majority in Congress. Name any kind of landmark legislation you can credit to Jimmy Carter. Zip. Zero. Labor law reform? Nope, not interested. Any of the important pieces of unfinished business that he might have enacted, that's not who he is. So you have another failed presidency. And worse, Carter begins the turn to neoliberalism. He decides, hey, we need deregulation. We need privatization. We need supply-side economics. The first supply-side bills, tax cuts for the rich, are not passed under Reagan. They're passed under Jimmy Carter. So, and then that begins a succession of neoliberal presidents, of whom the worst was Bill Clinton. And, you know, Clinton Clinton hires Bob Rubin and Larry Summers. He hires Wall Street to run the economy by and for Wall Street. He buys into the ideology of budget balance. And even worse, when after a few years, it all blows up in 2008, and Barack Obama, who really hadn't quite expected to be the nominee, realizes, oh my God, I'm going to be the nominee. And I wrote a book about this, the only book I ever wrote that ended up on the bestseller list, called Obama's Challenge. And it's June of 2008. He's got two people working for him, two and a half people, his entire economic team, one of whom is a really good guy named Dan Tarullo, a progressive. And Obama gives a speech at Cooper Union that March or April, talking about all the things that are wrong with Wall Street that need to be cleaned up. The speech is drafted by Tarullo. And then in June, when he realizes that he's going to be the nominee, all the financial heavy hitters in the party go to Obama and they say, hey, look, you got to bring in the A-team. Well, who's the A-team? Well, the A-team is Bob Rubin's proteges and Larry Summers and Rahm Emanuel and all of the people who bought the financial deregulation, brought the financial deregulation that caused the collapse of 2008. He brings them in to fix it. Summers' advice is, we don't need a big stimulus to deficit reduction. So the recession drags on and on and on, and that leads to directly to Trump. So you have three Democrats who gratuitously embrace neoliberalism because that's where the big money is. I mean, Rubin starts out as a fundraiser. He ends up becoming an advisor. He ends up being an ideologue. And of course, he comes from Wall Street. He goes back to Wall Street when they repeal the Glass-Steagall Act so that you can have an investment bank merge with a commercial bank known in some circles as the Citigroup Enabling Act. He becomes a top executive of Citigroup. So the whole thing is corrupt. It's a wasted opportunity. Obama is a magnificent human being. He's a person without a whiff of scandal attached to him. He's eloquent, but he bungles like Johnson with different dynamics, a moment that history hands him to be Roosevelt yet again. And so my question is, how in the hell are we going to get this back?
Well, two questions before we get to that. I had been appearing on Elliot Spitzer's program back in 2010. This is after he had to resign from governorship. But people may forget that as attorney general, he went after these bankers very, very hard. And I suspect that they were involved in helping expose his visiting of prostitutes, which caused his resignation. But he told me at one point, he said, I asked him, how is it that Obama is so enthralled by these people, being the Rubinites, as it were? Because many people voted for Obama thinking that they were going to get away from Rubinite. Rubin. And he said, you know, he didn't understand. He thinks these guys are masters of the universe. Spitzer said, I went to Princeton with these guys. I know they're all C students and they cheat at tennis, was his comment. But how is it that, I mean, how did Carter, this is what I'm like, I understand that like Clinton came in and I remember that election very clearly. I didn't start, I missed voting for Mondale against Reagan by a number of weeks at that time. But how did, what was going on that a conservative like Carter won the Democratic nomination? Did he project a populism because he was a peanut farmer and aw shucks and people sort of projected onto him an economic populism? What was it?
You know, so when Carter declared for the presidency, and this is the early spring of 1975, and I'm the junior man on the national staff at the Post, and I draw the assignment of going to the press club for Carter's announcement. I'm the only national reporter there, and his name recognition, not his support, but his name recognition is 2%. Okay?
Wow.
So in the course of a year and a half, he wages the ultimate outsider campaign. And after Nixon is impeached and the so-called Watergate class comes into office in January of 75, they're all process liberals. They're all let's clean up the you know, the ills that allowed Watergate to happen. And it's also a very weak field in 1976. And so people read their hopes onto Carter. He's an outsider. He's a peanut farmer. He's a Southerner. And he's an interesting character in that he represents the New South. He's a liberal on race. And Atlanta's the city that's too busy to hate. Remember that slogan? And so he's going to merge economic development and being a liberal on race and being a moderate on everything else. And he's going to get the community on his, the business community on his side. And that's the recipe that he commends to the country. And with the exception of Ramsey Clark, who we didn't quite realize how radical Ramsey Clark would turn out to be, and Ray Marshall, his labor secretary, his whole cabinet was fairly conservative. And even so, if it hadn't been for two things, he might have gotten reelected. I mean, he got very unlucky on the inflation, the OPEC inflation of the 70s. Right. And he got even more unlucky with the Iranian hostage crisis, which still comes back to haunt us. But his failure then opens the door to Reagan. And I want to come back to why we founded the Prospect and EPI. So if you think about what was going on in the 1980s, Reagan is president, supply side economics. He's phenomenally popular, deregulation. And the conventional wisdom at that point is, gee, the Democrats have a lot to learn from Reagan. The Democrats need to give up being economic populists and they need to become more like Reagan. And so several of us who were saying, no, God damn it, the Democrats need to be more plausible New Dealers. That's why we're getting killed. Working people don't trust the Democrats anymore. And Reagan is this sort of happy, sunny character. And so the first thing we did was we said, let's have an intellectually serious think tank that makes the case for progressive economics, not with rhetoric, but with research and with data. And so we raised some money. We founded the Economic Policy Institute. The Economic Policy Institute, you know, has become a landmark institute. Every year it publishes this State of Working America. It got famous for this iconic chart comparing the rate of productivity growth with the rate of worker wages. And up until the 70s, the two curves go in lockstep, and then it looks like an alligator's jaws where productivity goes through the roof and wages go flat. And then I think later in the decade, the same thing is happening with journals. The New Republic, otherwise known as the New Republic, and is becoming more like the right wing,
right.
Not just because Marty Peretz buys it, but because the conventional wisdom is, oh, we have a lot to learn from the Republicans. And Washington Monthly is formed to be an organ of neoliberalism. And so Paul Starr and Bob Reich and I said, no, man, we need to be more persuasive New Dealers for a different era, rather than saying, oh, we're also going to move to the center. And so we founded the Prospect. And you know, there's a chapter in my book called Winning the Arguments, Losing the Politics. And I think our arguments have been vindicated. Neoliberalism did not improve the rate of economic growth. It just made the rich richer and everybody else worse off. Corporate-sponsored free trade was good for Wall Street, was good for China, was bad for Americans in general. Deregulation was great for some industries. It was terrible for the whole ideal of managed capitalism. And so on one intellectual argument after another, We've been vindicated, but we keep losing the politics. And we keep losing the politics because the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party has all the money, and that has an immense amount of influence. And I also think, in fairness, and we can get into a whole separate debate about this, I think bringing black people and women and LGBT people into the mainstream of America with all of the rights that that conveys would have been really tough under the best of circumstances. Now, I, like a lot of other economic progressives, I think maybe our side overdid woke, but it was much, much harder than it needed to be because we fell down on the job of serving working people economically. And that made everything else much more arduous.
Yeah, I'm
so I will come back to Senator Proxmire when you want me to.
In one moment, because and this will lead into it. I know you've written a book too about the tax revolt era, and specifically Proposition 13 in California.
Right. My first book.
And I grew up in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts adopted, I think it was Prop 1.
Massachusetts had its own version of Prop 13.
Exactly. And I remember it very well because it was the year I was in high school, and all of a sudden we had nothing. I mean, the high schools were absolutely, I mean, I assume the elementary schools and the middle schools as well. But because this was, you know, property tax reform, our schools got particularly hit. What was the, in the country, I mean, because it feels like that anti-tax sentiment was really exploited to open the door to neoliberalism in many respects. Yep. And inject it in. So what was happening at that time where there was this turn on taxes?
Like, because you're freezing again.
Oh, sorry. That's okay. I don't know if you heard that question, but what was happening at the time in terms of this turn against taxes?
Yeah, I should say I don't have a doctorate. I dropped out of a PhD program at Berkeley because it was the 60s and I was restless. And I got my graduate education in political economy two ways. I got it at working as the chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee in the 70s. And then I got it in the early 80s when I wrote my first book, which was called Revolt of the Haves, which was a book about, gee, how did Proposition 13 happen to happen? And it's such an instructive story. And basically the story is this. In California in the 70s, you had a poisonous mix of inflation and a default by liberals to deal with the effect of inflation on property taxes. So here's what happened. Inflation is high in the 70s anyway. It's particularly high in California, where housing prices are going through the roof. And unless the state legislature or the governor or some combination of both intervene to keep higher housing prices from translating mechanically into higher property taxes are going to double and treble. And so that's what happened in 1976, 1977, 1978. Jerry Brown is governor. Jerry Brown at that point is hoping to run for president in 1980, and he's hoping to run for president, challenging Carter in the Democratic primaries, as a progressive who's also a fiscal conservative. And the way he's going to claim that he's a fiscal conservative is he wants the state budget in California to show a huge surplus. And how does he do that? Well, the more property taxes go through the roof, the less Sacramento has to part with local aid. And so Sacramento can bank this big surplus. So instead of realizing what a time bomb these property taxes and the property tax increases were, Jerry Brown sits on that state surplus. And meanwhile, people are being taxed out of their homes. And this screwball who completely anticipates Trump, named Howard Jarvis, who nobody had taken seriously, comes out of nowhere, sponsors Proposition 13 to cut property taxes by over $6 billion, and Prop 13 wins almost 2-1. That's 2 years before Reagan is elected. And interestingly, that is taken as a turn against big government. It was not a turn against government. It was a turn against the unfair allocation of the tax burden. And if Democrats had not bungled that, they would have beaten it. They would have used state aid to cut property taxes. So it's a classic case of what happens when Democrats bungle a genuine economic grievance. The right takes over. The right articulates it. That prefigures Trump by about 50 years. It's the same story. And then it spreads like wildfire. It happens in state after state. Massachusetts, interestingly, I've been in Massachusetts since 1979. We tried four times to get tax reform. And the good guys finally did it a couple of years ago with a ballot initiative to tax millionaires. They added a tax bracket to the tax code. First time we've ever had a progressive tax in Massachusetts, but limited to millionaires. Now, you know what the governor did? The governor is kind of a centrist Democrat. She gave a lot of it back. And this produced windfalls for housing and transportation. And on the one hand, she took credit for it, even though she was opposed to it. I mean, they had to go around the governor, around the legislature with a ballot initiative to get this thing passed. They had to pass it twice, because it was a constitutional amendment. She gives a lot of it back and then takes credit for the increased spending on transportation and housing. So, you know, this is the power of economic populism. And it's also the power of dropping the ball economically and letting the other side articulate grievances.
Right. Let's talk about your time on the Senate Committee on Banking and Housing and Urban Affairs, and you're working for Senator William Proxmire from Wisconsin. And this is what you attribute at least a big part of your political economy education to. And you work on the Community Reinvestment Act, which ends up being a scapegoat in 2008. In many circles, for the financial crisis. The ability of those neoliberal forces and Democrat and Republican, to just like lesser degrees, I guess, or a question of degree between the two of them, their capacity to shape these narratives in the public is. There's just, you know, EPI is one of those ways in which I know that I, as a commentator, have used resources from you guys for 20 some odd years now, pushing back on these narratives. But it's an uphill struggle because there's a lot more resources on the other side to create these sort of fictional things. We can get into why the Democrats never exploited Kansas after Art Laffer went there with Sam Brownback. But tell us what you learned on this committee. Also, both in terms of like the political economy, but also in terms of like how hearings are supposed to function. Because to me, when we look to the there's going to be so many challenges going forward. But at least in the short term, maximizing the value of hearings, it seems to me, is going to be the best opportunity for Democrats to reorient.
So, very early 1975, Proxmire, who was a great progressive, totally honorable, decent guy, nice guy, smart guy, becomes chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. And so he gets a bunch of staff slots. He's looking for a chief investigator, and he hires me. And I report for work, and the first thing that happens is the staff director hands me a folder called redlining. And Proxmire had been the chairman of the Subcommittee on Consumer Affairs. He'd started working on redlining. Redlining, I think, as most of your listeners know, is the process by which banks, with the complicity of the FHA, by the way, literally draw red lines around neighborhoods that are minority or that are deemed to be changing, and you can't get ordinary mortgage loans in those neighborhoods. And so a remarkable coalition of community groups, a lot of them are Alinsky organizers, in the mode of Saul Alinsky, where local people really take the leadership on issues. And a number of community groups start saying, hey, look, the enemy is not black people. The enemy is banks. And a certain amount of racial change is normal. And we want to welcome black neighbors, but at a pace that is socially bearable so that it doesn't lead to panic selling on the part of white people. And so you have this amazing multiracial coalition doing research by going to recorders of deeds one transaction at a time and looking at which banks are still lending in these old neighborhoods and which banks are pulling out deposits but not putting in loans. And so after about a week on the job, a delegation of about 20 of these amazing people, led by a woman named Gail Sincotta out of Chicago's West Side, comes and meets with me and presents their research to me. And I said, wow, this is really impressive. What do you folks want? And they said, well, we want two things. First of all, we want federal legislation that would require banks to disclose by zip code or by census tract where they are making loans so that we don't have to do this research one transaction at a time. And secondly, we'd like Proxmire to hold hearings on this to expose some of the abuses. I said, wow, that is really fantastic. And I was really even more impressed by the fact that this is a multiracial coalition. Now, this is 1975. This is less than a decade after Stokely Carmichael kicks whites out of the movement. Remember that? Mm-hmm. And there were not a lot of multiracial coalitions floating around in 1975. So I presented this to Proxmire and to my boss, the staff director, Ken McLean. And they said, yeah, this is great. Go for it. So I had early in my career, I had worked in radio and television, but you want to produce for dramatic effect. And so we had 4 days of hearings and we invited a number of these community groups to tell their stories. And we also invited a bunch of bankers so that Proxmire could beat up on them. And we found two good guy bankers, who one from Philadelphia, one from Chicago, who were committed to putting money back into the old neighborhoods. And then the grassroots groups did a huge amount of lobbying with other grassroots groups. And we caught the bankers kind of asleep at the switch. And we passed the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, requiring disclosure of lending, by two votes in the Senate. And then we tacked it onto a must-pass housing bill in the House. And it becomes law. And then we said, hey, we got a cool coalition here. What else can we do? And then we come up with a Community Reinvestment Act, which provides that not only do banks have to disclose, but they have an affirmative obligation to seek out lending opportunities in old neighborhoods, in changing neighborhoods. And here's the crucial line, which gives the lie to the slander of 2008, consistent with sound lending standards. Consistent with sound lending standards. And so by 2008, the wise guys on Wall Street had invented exploding subprime mortgages. If the bank regulators had followed the Community Reinvestment Act, subprime mortgages would have been illegal. So quite apart from the charge that the Community Reinvestment Act was somehow the culprit, it was the failure to enforce the Community Reinvestment Act that caused the collapse of 2008. But because Obama and his people, Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, and Larry Summers, the top economic guy, were so weak in holding the banks accountable, that narrative took hold.
I mean, to be fair to them, maybe they weren't just weak in holding the banks accountable. They were there sort of providing a concierge service for the banks. And We should say, you know, I mean, I still remember the story that was retold by Barney Frank at the time that Paulson had said to him, I'm willing to go directly to the homeowners, but Obama's got to sign off on it. And according to Barney Frank, said Obama, who was then president-elect, said there's only one president at a time, sort of allowing Bush to start the process of we're going to pay off the banks and hope they do right by the homeowners. That, of course, ended up, you know, with that and TARP and everything else ended up not working out in the way that they supposedly assumed it would.
Well, so two stories. Barney Frank was chairman of the House Banking Committee and, of course, the co-sponsor of the Dodd-Frank bill. But Rahm Emanuel, who was then chief of staff previously to Obama, previously had been the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Rahm saw the House Banking Committee as a chance for corporate Democrats to raise a lot of money from bankers. And he loaded Barney's committee up with so many corporate Democrats. The worst case just got reelected to Congress, by the way, Melissa Bean, that Barney didn't control his own committee. And so the Dodd-Frank Act was weaker than it might have been because there were so many corporate Democrats on the House Banking Committee. The other story is that, you know, as a condition of passing that bill, when Bush was still president, the Democrats insisted on having a congressional oversight panel, and some obscure Harvard professor named Elizabeth Warren was named to be chairman of the oversight panel. That's how Warren came to prominence. And Warren her deputy, Damon Silvers, who was the AFL-CIO's chief guy on corporate finance, they became kind of Obama's loyal opposition. And as a condition of passing that aid, they insisted that $50 billion be set aside so that homeowners could get refinanced mortgages so that they wouldn't lose their homes. Geithner refused to spend most of the money. Most of that money reverted to the Treasury. I mean, there, you know, it's if you look at who Obama ended up appointing, it's like Roosevelt had appointed Herbert Hoover's economic team.
Yeah.
It's the people who caused the crisis were put in charge of economic policy for a supposed reform president.
Yeah.
And that's how the right captured the narrative.
Yeah, I think so. And we see it time and time. There was another Reubenite, Froman, I think his name was John Froman,
who was
in charge of the trade. And I'm quite convinced that the TPP also damaged Hillary Clinton's chances in 2016. And just the fact that it was in the air was very helpful to Donald Trump.
Absolutely right.
We could go on and on in that respect. But let's just talk about looking forward, because you do say American democracy will probably survive Trump. And it's you know, to the extent that we have an American democracy, it may be the case. I had a very interesting interview last week with a professor who's written that he perceives that from the beginning, more or less, we've had both an oligarchy and a democracy running concurrently, building on the work of his name escapes me from Princeton. But that when any issue involving money, essentially, comes up, the wealthy win. And then for the rest of the issues, there's more or less democracy. But when we talk about sort of like broad structural stuff in terms of the economics. So when you say that process Democrats came in the wake of Watergate, or I should say process liberals. One of my concerns, and it seems like there's been an attempt to have those return on some level. In many respects, Joe Biden was a at least one as a process liberal. He did some things that I know that you and I both appreciate, some things that he did not. But leaving that aside, how do we get back on track and return to a sort of a New Deal disposition among Democrats where along fighting that process, liberal impulse that would come in after what is probably the most corrupt presidency in the history of the country, or at least in modern era?
Well, okay. So just to be clear, you need both. You need all kinds of process reform, and you need substantive progressivism. Because even if you, you know, get rid of the corruption and put big money back in its place, you then have to take that and run with it and get substantive progressivism so that ordinary people have a prospect of making a decent living. So you need both. First, you got to get elected. You got to elect a president and a Democratic Congress in 2028. Now, what are the chances of that? So here's where the last couple of chapters of my book are both optimistic and not so optimistic. Here's the optimistic part. I think against all odds, democracy seems to be holding. Trump is overplaying his hand. The Iran war is a catastrophe. Republicans are beginning to defect. He's got this Hail Mary pass notion that if I can just get control of elections, then I can stage a kind of a coup. But I don't think the Senate's going to pass the SAVE Act. Even though he's won some court decisions on the most important court decisions, like birthright citizenship, like can he federalize the National Guard, like can he fire the Federal Reserve. He's lost some key decisions. And the lower courts just are overruling his attempt to get control of elections by executive orders. And I think, I wouldn't bet my life on it, but I think we're probably going to have reasonably honest elections this fall. And I think it's going to be a Democratic wave. Okay, that's maybe the good news. But if you look at the kind of social contract that my generation, and maybe to some extent, Sam, your generation had, debt-free college, housing that you can afford, that builds equity over a lifetime, jobs that are not gigs, that lead to careers, jobs that have decent pensions, not just gigs. How on earth do you recreate that social contract for children and grandchildren of people my age? And my punchline is, wow, that's going to take a politics and a set of policies at least as radical as Roosevelt. And I haven't seen one of these 2029 blueprints that goes far enough.
No.
I mean, you take the case of health insurance. Even if we had Medicare for all, and we keep these for-profit middlemen who are sucking money out of the healthcare system, that would just add costs. And Obamacare, as far as it went, because it worked through private insurers, you're subsidizing an inefficient system. So to be a liberal, you need to be a radical at times. And I have a line in the book where I say, I don't think I've become more Marxian. I think the world has become more Marxian. And this is a society of extractive capitalism, the kind of capitalism that operated after World War II when markets were well regulated and entrepreneurs actually delivered real stuff. That's gone. We have extractive capitalism. We have hedge funds and private equity and tech bros and surveillance capitalism. And to get back a kind of social democratic economy that serves ordinary people is really going to take radical reforms. I don't know, even if we get democracy back, even if we elect a president who's a Democrat and a Democratic Congress, you know, you need a president who's both a visionary and a practical politician, and that's going to take some doing.
Well, hope springs eternal, I guess. Bob Cutler.
It has to.
Indeed. The book is Notes for Next Time, Can't recommend it enough. Fascinating story. We barely scratched the surface of your really, David Dayen said, Zelig-like life in terms of both politics and the journalism, politics from both a journalist and a an economist and a working for the government. Bob Kuttner, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We are back, folks. Hope you enjoyed that conversation between Sam and Robert Kuttner. And we're going to wrap up the free part of this show and head into the fun half soon. As a reminder, this show relies on your support. Join themajorityreport.com. Helps us survive and thrive. You can IM into the show. We'll read your IMs. Please do. It would be very helpful if you could become members. I don't know how to end these pitches in an artful way, but that is Grandma. And we now have Brandon Sutton with us. Hello, Brandon.
That's right. Hello, that's right. Emma.
Hello. I'm feeling so weird today with like the air quality. I don't know what's going on. I've got like brain fog or something. It's so odd.
I feel
outside.
like sort of permanently lightheaded.
Exactly. Yeah. And slow. I'm like, are the words coming out of my mouth making sense? I'm not quite sure, but
hard to enunciate too because my throat's like swollen.
Exactly. It's bad. It's bad over here. But what's happening on the discourse in lighter news?
Oh, I don't know if it's in lighter news because we were covering the miasma that has engulfed the United States. I like to think that it's a metaphor for Trump's rule. Like he has this kind of like toxic spiritual and now literal miasma that like just descends upon America. But we've been covering, and I think we need to catch back up on this, the ongoing case against Tyler Robinson, what's happening there, and how the right-wing media sphere has basically, I think, had another civil war over this particular case. I mean, it's basically Candace versus everybody. No, Candace versus the narrative, right? Although,
are her and Tucker still on the same side, or is that sort of like, where's Tucker at? I saw him say he feels sorry for Trump the way he would feel sorry for any slave.
Oh, shut up! Slave to Israel. He has agency,
he's
you
so
psycho.
Funny. Tucker is an expert fence sitter. Like of all the people who may be like true believers versus grifters, like Tucker is a chameleon, and he has been his entire career, you know, on the right wing side. And so Tucker is like grift maxing, and I think that he's managed to fence sit on the appropriate issues in such a way. I don't know what his like in detail opinions about the Tyler Robinson case are. I feel like he's barely touched it compared to people like Candace or even like Alex Jones more recently. And, you know, not the, you know, real Alex Jones, obviously the clone that has replaced him that we are, you know, also obviously calling Alex Jones, obviously.
But
we've been keeping up with that. So I would definitely recommend going over and joining the discourse because we are actually a little bit less than 900 subscribers away from 25,000 subscribers on YouTube.
Hey,
they said you are growing at a clip here.
I am growing at a clip, much like a newborn baby. I am getting larger every time you see me. Every time you go to buy me a new pair of shoes, you think to yourself, God damn, this little something's feet is getting bigger every time. And,
wow.
You know, honestly, it's true. It's true. Soon they'll have to invent a whole new element to make a plaque for me for YouTube out of something radioactive. Brandonium.
Brandonium, right? That does
Brandonium.
Work. Right.
That's
that has
right.
The same subtlety as James Cameron's choice to call the entity or like the resource that they're trying to get in Avatar unobtainium.
I think subtlety is for losers. I think
I
that
would
like
agree.
Subtlety is for people who don't want to take responsibility for what they actually believe. I would never choose to be subtle, use subtext, make hints, leave clues. You know, that's
come
what you
out
get
and
on
say
discourse.
It.
Unfiltered, unfiltered psychological warfare aimed at you and your community. So go over to the discourse with Brandon on YouTube or Twitch and hit that like and subscribe button. Smash that bell that tells you when I'm on and just start plugging yourself into what's really going on.
Yeah. Tag, plug into the matrix, folks, and subscribe to the discourse. You are truly a gem, my friend. Matt Binder, hello. Good to see you.
Hello, good to see you too. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. What's happening over on your show, Zuh?
Just tune into youtube.com/MattBinder and be wowed anytime you see something pop up or I go live because
okay. It's the spontaneity is part of the fun. Matt Leck,
right,
what's
exactly.
happening with you? Sorry.
Yeah, over on Left Reckoning, we talked Sam Karras about the Big Bend wall, which is only really making the contractors happy, and scarring a pristine landscape, and also talked to Ishmael Johnson about the cost of youth sports in the wake of soccer commentator Alexi Lalas wondering who's going to pay for all this free soccer that we apparently need to compete at the highest level, and we haven't paid for it, so now we can. Tomorrow on the Jackman Show, Brendan James of Blowback Podcast talking about their series on Israel, No Daylight, and the relationship between Israel and America.
All right, folks, we will see you in the fun half.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the majority report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
No, I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why.
So it's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Sushi and poker with the boys. So it's offered a tour.
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour. Sushi and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour. Sushi and poker with the boys. So it's offered a tour. Sushi and
that's what we call biz.
Tour. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour. Sushi and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Twerk. Ugh. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Twerk. Wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
Someone's offered a twerk.
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Twerk. Sushi and poker with the boys. Boy.
Twerk. I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a little kid. Little kid. I think I'm like a kid.
Had this debate 7,000 times.
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing meat with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here. Okay, all right.
It's not a fun job.
Twerk? That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Boys. Willy Wonka
twerk? That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
What's that offered to twerk?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Boys. That's
a twerk?
A real thing.
That's real thing. Real thing.
What's that offered to twerk?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker.
Let's go, Joe.
What's going on?
Live YouTube.
Sam has
Twitch.
The weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you.
You were happy. Let's change the subject.
Right. Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is the pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet.
Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't ditch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people.
Love it.
you are to the right of me on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I don't have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
I Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like, period.
We are back, folks. This is the fun half of the Majority Report, and we are about to have some fun. Okay. I know that most people would like to not think about Joe Biden anymore. Trust me, I am in that same camp.
Come on.
But, you know, we should probably remind people that the Democratic Party as an institution was insistent that this man would be able to serve 4 more years as president. I'm a little skeptical of that assertion. I don't know.
Yeah, I actually think the results are in on that.
Oh, really?
He'd be president right now.
This guy would be president right now. So he's coming out with a book, which, you know, I honestly watched the trailer or the promo for it, and I almost sent it in our Slack to be like, okay, we should cover this because it was a pre-recorded, like, edited promo. And you can barely understand him, and they must have taken multiple takes, and that was the best they could do. But I was like, oh, come on, like, what's the point of this? However, this video is too, I mean, seemingly insane to pass up. This is at Biden's 92Y event.
Well, it's not. It's at Jill Biden's 92Y
event. Oh, I'm sorry.
For her book.
Okay.
Which is in part why this is so confusing.
So this is, I guess, from a little while ago.
June 3rd, I believe.
Okay, but they finally released some video of it to Alex Thompson.
So, yeah, what's happening is Jill's has her own book out, and she's talking with Whoopi Goldberg up at the 92Y, who I believe have bad history about maybe platforming or not platforming people critical of certain events in across the world.
92Y, anyway, yes, yeah. Yes. It's very Zionist friendly,
right.
Yes.
So, so Jill Biden had an event there with Whoopi Goldberg, and they're trying to wrap this up, and there was reporting here, like Alex Thompson said, some news in this odd story. Biden told the crowd at 92Y that his book is coming out in September before the midterms. Now, that is contrary to what everyone had been saying, which is they're going to release the book after the midterms so that Democrats don't have to fucking deal with it.
Right, because he's like a political albatross.
Yeah, it's a massive blow to their credibility. And they, exactly. So, nonetheless, this happened at the end of this event, and the 92Y has released video of this moment, so let's enjoy this.
And I do like Biden trying to plug his own book at this event, which is supposed to be for his wife.
Yeah, I think you could say he makes it about himself.
No!
Yeah.
So they give him a standing ovation, and he's like, now it's my time to make this about me.
Okay.
Fish the horror music.
Here I go, Jack.
His aides are like, the security guy's like, sir, go try to climb up.
Oh, Joe has a question. Like you couldn't ask it later?
She's mad.
So he asks her here, who do you love most in the whole world?
Okay.
It's just a baby.
I mean, how old are
it's like
you,
shaking
bro?
A rattle. We're Benjamin Button here. Yeah.
Why can't you let your wife have her moment instead of saying, bro, don't you love me?
Stay seated and enjoy the show.
He self-centered like a child is, not like a narcissist. This is just a baby.
I
think he's fully gone. I think he's fully gone.
Who do you love most in the whole world?
Whoopi.
And so I'm going to do the last.
No. I love you most, Joe. Was that it? Is that the answer he wanted?
Yes.
Overwhelming. Well, that's what keeps him on his toes. Yeah. He's never 100% sure. I always keep him guessing. Is that not true?
Does the sign of the cross.
And so the last thing I have to say is Moving on. People.
He's just standing at the edge of the stage.
Now I know it's his books.
Is it like the rule that you have to stand when the president is standing?
It looks like Gooks. I'm thinking.
And then there's this little awkward part where she misreads the word books as a slur. Well, just maybe.
Yeah. Okay.
It looks like Gooks. I'm thinking, what are Gooks? But I'm going to remind them. But I'm to remind people to pick up books on your way out. The name of the book is The View from the East Wing. And that concludes our conversation.
Thank you so much.
I want to see him try to get on that stage.
Well, he's not done yet. And I know
it's going to be Bill Withers. Okay. All right, Bill Withers.
Fade that out because Joe's got his hand up.
I'm speaking. Mr. President, I'm speaking.
Sir.
My book, which comes out in September. Read it.
Well, I have to remind them this is my event.
Oh, my God.
The only thing Jill does better than write, she's a beautiful woman.
Oh.
That's so diminishing.
No, I think
she's a good writer, but you know what else she was even better at? Looking pretty.
Looking hot.
Yeah. With her mouth closed. I think that Joe Biden is fully gone. In fact, this might be a hot take, but I think that Joe Biden is like cognitively worse than Donald Trump is.
I agree that's
just only obscured by the fact that despite that, Donald Trump is still a worse president. Like, despite, like,
exactly.
not literally being, like, a cognitive zombie, he is still a terrible president who will likely go down as the worst president of ever. In fact, you know, if it weren't for how bad of a president he actually is, we would probably have to deal with more of the fallout for how, like, I mean, essentially what happened with the Joe Biden situation, especially the rapid implosion of his candidacy. But because Donald Trump came in so bad so quickly, it kind of all got, you know, swept under the rug because, like, yeah, he might be brain dead, but as people see that, like, even a vegetable is a better president than Donald Trump. Maybe we'll get Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
Well,
we've already moved to the stage where Democrat establishment is like, we vet our candidates. Like, you tried to run a vegetable.
Exactly. Well, yeah. And I think, though, why it's important to continuously remind people of this, and where I don't think the voters have forgotten, although the Democratic Party institution wants you to forget, is that this whole failed attempt to, you know, get this guy to be a two-term president, despite what we're all seeing, is an example of the lack of internal democracy in the Democratic Party and the fact that the institution has almost become a corporatized one that is entirely disconnected from the will of their own voting base, and that they actively almost kind of enjoy telling the voting base to sit down and take it on a variety of different issues. But this one is a visible example of that, because you can see literally in Biden's deterioration in front of our eyes how the Democratic Party was so invested in gaslighting the public to get him across the finish line instead of just showing some level of democratic responsiveness. And I still maintain this, that you can't run against Donald Trump on a democracy platform, especially when you're not offering that much materially to change people's lives, and then not perform democracy yourself, which is just literally listening to your voters and doing elections and then having the democratic process play out in debates and primaries, et cetera. They like foreclosed that possibility and then tried to lecture the rest of the country on the will of the people, but while they were also committing genocide.
I think we're in such like a tumultuous time in terms of party establishments being hated. There should be the sort of presumption that whoever's the nominee or whoever's the president shouldn't face any kind of a primary for their second term. I think unless you are massively popular, which Biden wasn't, it should be foregone that the party's going to challenge you. You're going to have debates. I'm sorry, it will take you away from AUKUS or whatever foreign policy stuff you're doing. And like there needs to be democracy. You need to, and because otherwise you're just letting the other party train its sights on you the entire time, and also get people's attention with all their ideas on their primary.
And they simulate democratic responsiveness by like saying, oh, we'll give you the Epstein files. Oh, you know, this is a popular thing. We'll say what you want to hear. They have no compunction about doing that. I mean, we were just covering Josh Hawley yesterday, and he tried to launder himself as some sort of right-wing populist, and he just says functionally everything that the Republican Party does, but he'll throw out conspiracy chum on some sort of cable news appearance, and that is their version of like satiating the public. But the Democrats should be doing so substantively, and they refuse to do that. But like and part of that clip made me sad to a degree. It's not fun to see somebody deteriorating like that in front of your very eyes. But then I remember what a monster he is.
Yeah,
and
I had a blast watching.
I don't. I put that momentary empathy out of my brain. I did feel almost a little bit bad for Jill Biden as well. But then I remember that she was one of the people most responsible for propping this guy up.
Yep.
When it was abundantly clear that he couldn't continue to lead the country.
I mean, he can't be trusted to like let you finish a book talk.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I just guess because their body language, and I hate to do body language analysis on like, you know, remotely, but like when he came to the stage, their body language just seemed so tense, especially Joe Biden's, like this, like, okay, but you know, Joe Biden is not in his right mind. Like, what might he do? Like, she seemed like almost ready to like intercede, like jump in, because who knows what he might say. He's also the former president, so if he asks for a mic, they're just going to give him one, but she has to be his caregiver essentially. And the first thing that I think when I see something like that is like, how long has he been this way? Like, how long has he been this way? Because they wanted you to think that, oh, the moment he's no longer president, we suddenly found that he had cancer, like aggressive form of cancer, and it just started then. And you know, Joe Biden was saying part of this book tour that the first time she ever noticed anything about Joe was during that debate performance, which does not even reflect what we heard from people like George Clooney, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, he's just been like this in some capacity for a very long time. And I mean, I think that that's very scandalous. But of course, because of the two-party system, you know, the conversation can't really be had, much like you're saying about, you know, like them being able to speak to certain values that they don't have,
yes,
or certain they'll never do, because we have a two-part system. Like, there's just never really a good environment to have these kinds of conversations, or they only happen at the conversation level.
And when we're talking also about credibility as well, sorry, Binder, I'll shut up in a second, but like, when you are saying to people, don't believe your lying eyes about this man. Remember in the wake of that debate, the headlines were, he still has sex with his wife. And also, he's this foreign policy wunderkind. Like, you lose credibility. The Republicans have no problem lying to you so that they can get some sort of cheap credibility to achieve their own ends. And the Democrats choose to box out the public and gaslight them. And then people wonder why, like, they don't understand fundamentally that the Democrats are better for the country than the Republicans. That's the problem. And I just want to read this IM really quickly. Tempe from Maryland says, when was the last time we got a real Democratic primary? 2008? Yeah. I mean, and why do you think that the democracy message is stale? So
I still want to book him for his book tour.
Oh, me too. I would love to conduct that interview. Well, actually,
I mean, might be able to book him in September, even though the book doesn't come out till November.
What'll he know? He won't know anything.
Yeah, trying to get him on our service that
on Ping.
Yeah.
I can't figure it out.
Filibuster Bluth, Brandon is legally required to say, I don't want to do body language analysis before he starts doing body language analysis.
No, he just doesn't want to do it not in person.
Remotely.
If it was in person, he'd be...
Yes, right. Like a doctor. Good. Doctors can't diagnose over,
oh, yeah,
over,
no,
over video or over the phone. Yeah.
If I was the designated body... Yeah, if I was the designated body language analysis of this event, I would have no problem with, like, you know, delivering my professional opinion. But yeah, across these, like, you know, these mediums, you find yourself just like losing a lot. A lot gets lost in translation. But I would say she seemed very tense. Like, oh my God, what might Joe do? Might he just fall? Might he jump on the stage? Because he's fallen before, right? We don't want him to have like a Mitch McConnell.
Cedar, I hardly know her, says, I've seen enough. I'm riding with Biden 2028. Uday and Kuse Lutnick, she's good at doing her girl writing, but just look at her man.
Don't think she's just better in writing than seven legs.
Bench press Shapiro, Joe Biden looks like a Madame Tussauds wax figure crossed with a human Ken doll. Well, the way he walks is certainly like a Ken doll. Sam C. Doyle, Matt and Brian, what software do you guys use for the soundboard? iTunes?
I have two. One of them is just the Finder, and I have a big folder that I can just find it. I found that to be a little bit easier. I also use something called podcastsoundboard.com.
That is grandma.
That is grandma. Okay, let's... before we get to this, I want to quickly just make sure that we touch on the Todd Blanche clip. Todd Blanche, the acting attorney general, was grilled in his Senate confirmation hearing yesterday, even though it's probably going to be largely symbolic because Trump can just keep him as acting attorney general and he doesn't necessarily need to get confirmed. But, you know, this is the guy who, as the head of the Department of Justice, settled Trump's $10 billion frivolous lawsuit against the IRS. And the way that he settled it was by setting up that infamous weaponization fund, the $1.8 billion weaponization fund, that was actually like a really big political misstep. It traveled across, I think, even into Republican circles, so they had to abandon it because it was literally a fund to pay out to Trump, maybe himself, to his loyalists, and to January Sixers, money that the administration was claiming was like a part of reparations for their sacrifice. It was just like the most open corruption possible. And here is Senator Kennedy throwing up a softball to Blanche, and he accidentally slips here in a very Freudian manner, and this is obviously going viral and making the rounds.
Are you and President Trump friends?
I'm his lawyer, was his lawyer, and now I'm the Deputy Attorney General. So I met him as his criminal defense attorney. I'm not sure there's very many people who have ever had a criminal defense attorney who calls that person their friend. I now have a...
Well, let me put it this way. Are you enemies?
How about Roy Cohn?
No, we're not enemies at all. No.
Have you ever...
Yeah, good point. Robert Kardashian, right, literally represented OJ. That was a little bit revealing, I would say, because we've hammered that point before. I mean, he was essentially acting as his personal lawyer when he went to Ghislaine Maxwell and got her to stay pretty quiet about Trump and their connections. And then, you know, just coincidentally, she got transferred to one of the nicest prisons in the country, got a puppy against protocol because she's a sex offender. That's not supposed to be legally permissible.
And no one's taking responsibility for how that decision got made.
Yeah. Although, don't worry, there were some recordings that Todd Blanche released showing that she says in their conversation that Trump committed no wrongdoing with Jeffrey Epstein, so we should just trust this inherently.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what motivation would she have for, say, like, the guy who could pardon her?
Or at the very least, like, yeah, make her... what? I mean, they would pardon her if there was no political blowback, but they don't...
Oh, absolutely.
They can't. They realize they couldn't. Yeah.
Oh, no, absolutely. And don't forget the James O'Keefe, like, a honeypot operation that caught that Bureau of Prisons guy on camera, you know, giving what he said afterwards was only his opinion that it was a sign that there was some kind of quid pro quo deal between, like, Ghislaine Maxwell and Todd Blanche, right? So, I mean, the whole thing stinks to high heaven.
Yeah. Here is Todd Blanche, I guess this was in April, talking about...
Somebody he's not friends with?
With Trump, who he's not friends with. They're just professional colleagues. And
is that loyalty?
Todd Blanche is, he's my client. He's my client. There's nothing improper here. This is how most lawyers speak about their clients, I guess.
I love working for President Trump. It's the greatest honor of a lifetime. And if President Trump chooses to keep me as acting, That's an honor. If he chooses to nominate me, that's an honor. If he chooses to nominate somebody else and I go back to being the DAG, that's an honor. If he chooses to nominate somebody else and asks me to go do something else, I will say, thank you very much. I love you, sir. So I don't have any goals or
aspirations. Ew, what?
I was not expecting that last little line there. I love you, sir. Yeah. Okay.
I mean,
Cuck-a-mack thing.
Right. I love you, sir. Can I? If he chooses to just step on my balls, I'll say thank you, sir. I love you.
Thank you, sir. Can I have another?
Biggest honor of a lifetime to have your heel on my balls, sir.
Yes, yes, exactly. Anything you want, sir. I love you. I'm in love with you. I'll do anything for you, please. I pine for you. I yearn for you.
I only wish you stamped harder so the imprint of your foot was there for a lifetime. Yes.
If only for a moment I could be a can of Diet Coke just to feel your lips against me.
Oh, yeah. Like, MAGA is this, like, sadomasochistic cult. It's so clear where, like, Big Daddy Trump gets to do whatever he wants to you, and then you get to do whatever you want to your underling. It's a very, right, like, toxic pyramid scheme.
Yeah. John Cornyn, Republican senator from Texas, outgoing.
Oh, yes. The only people grilling these nominees, these cowards, are Cornyn and Tillis. Occasionally Tillis, yeah, because they've already been ousted by Trump, essentially.
But so he had asked this on the weaponization fund. And, you know, the Democrats got some licks in too, but it's funnier when Republicans dark, because it's, yeah, like, you know, dog bites Matt. But here's him asking about weaponization.
Finally, let me just go back to the in the 50 seconds I have, go back to this release. This purports to release lawfare or weaponization and or weaponization. Those aren't legal terms of art, are they?
I think they are just legal terms of art. They're not. There's not.
Have
any...
they been defined in any case or any statute?
Not that I'm aware of. No.
So they're not a legal term of art.
Well, I think that the terms have been used by the legal community and by people within government. But no, I'm not sure that they're in Black's Law Dictionary.
But we don't.
Yeah. So they're building this off of this horseshit, which was whatever Stephen Miller decides.
Yep. Right. Right. Yeah. That's not. I'm not sure that's a legal term.
Yeah. I mean, it got so much bad press because of the Jan Sixers and like their recidivism rate. I don't know if you guys covered that one January 6th.
Yes.
Was literally, oh, yeah. So do you know who exactly I'm talking about, who wanted to use as bribe money for his, yes, like, Trump crimes, if you know what I mean?
He was abusing minors and was using the promise of, like, the weaponization fund as a way to, what, like, pay them off or use leverage against them?
Yeah, he's going to say, like, look, I'm going to come into a bunch of money, so yep, the money will be yours as long as you keep quiet.
Keep quiet, right. Yeah.
That's disgusting.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a mafioso administration.
No doubt. Tayshu says, I know it's low on the list of things happening for the moment, but I heard Chuck Schumer farting on the Senate floor yesterday, and I thought y'all should know. New York Post posted the video. Yes, I've seen the video. I still sometimes... I poo-pooed it when someone wrote in about it before, because it's... like, I see some of these videos, and it's like, okay, it could have been a mic mess-up or whatever. This was one of the more convincing fart videos I'd seen.
Well, in Chuck Schumer's defense, a lot of people would love a video of Mitch McConnell walking around live farting right now to verify that he's still alive. And so if nothing else, this like powerful and vibrant expulsion of gas has shown that like the Democratic Party, yeah, leadership is a lot more like alive, I guess is the best word to put it, than some of the like elderly leadership of the Republican Party. So checkmate.
All right,
I guess
fine.
We have to watch this now.
I guess we'll watch it now.
I haven't seen it. I'm very excited.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either, and Brandon just totally sold it for me. I mean
I really did.
More excited to watch someone fart.
That's getting clipped, Bender.
The New York Post text here is really good.
Yeah.
The American people need to know, of course, how and why this chaos is spreading through their streets, and we need complete investigation that's independent. Now on Iran and the NDAA. When all the Trump administration...
I don't know.
Why did it come at that moment? It's the perfect... Now when Iran and the NDAA.
Yeah.
Wait, is that the real one? Because that, it sounded more subtle in the video that I'd heard. That, is that from
that
the
sounds
post?
Like, is his ass mic'd?
Yeah, it's right.
It's too up front.
Well, he does, the thing is, he does a shimmy and a shoulder shake almost, like as if he's, as you say, powerful, power, it is a powerful and violent expulsion, which would require some, yeah, movement in his body at this age. Here we go.
Yeah, an alpha demonstration.
Now on Iran and the NDAA. When all the Trump administration can say,
and he laughed a little. He laughed a little.
I wonder if they like, juiced it, like the sound, like you know.
I wonder
to make it
too.
More
Matt, is this actually the New York Post? Yeah. It's coming from them, not directly. It's
well,
not
that's
somebody.
Reliable reporting.
Look.
I don't know if they would edit a video like this though. Like if they verified. Gave out a false one. They probably
get sued
probably,
for.
Yes, get sued. I'm just saying it's a paper and not someone. It's
well,
not like a
White
viral
House.
Account on Twitter doing it.
Here's the White House version.
Okay, great. Oh, the White
now
House.
Now on Iran and the NDAA. When all the Trump administration.
Oh, God.
Wait, what's with the sombrero?
Because it's
does
the White House. It's the White House account.
You just have to, like, make them look Mexican because we're that racist,
yep.
even though it has
like
nothing
beans,
to do
with beans, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, Mexicans like beans. Is that it?
Oh, maybe
that is
that's still a huge stretch.
Yeah, I mean, you could have also threw up a Nancy Mace cutout face over him. I mean, she likes beans too.
Oh, right, you nasty ass bitch.
Yeah,
more
that will live
in
infamy, Kyle Kalinske.
Sure. She's like the bean queen. I think she's like the bean queen.
Bean
like,
queen.
I've never met a Mexican who loves beans as much as Nancy Mace does. Just based
well,
on that. Like,
I mean, Nancy Mace, she says she's going to run.
Like a blurb for her cookbook.
Yeah. Nancy Mace says she might run for Lindsey Graham's vacant seat. So, you know.
She'd be an improvement.
Two people with immense rectal integrity would live in that seat. I'm just saying, if she eats that many beans, she's got to be able to control it. And for Lindsey,
oh
we know
oh
what's
boy.
Up.
That was, wasn't expecting that. Let's put it that way. Yeah. I mean, I'm used to... Chuck Schumer whiffing on Iran, right? But
all right, guys, you got me to do a potty humor segment. All right, congrats. Trump changed as Schumer was just farting a sad trombone. More adventurous. Great point about just saying what you mean by Brandon. People around me are often are hunting around. It's confusing sometimes and can lead to misunderstandings. I haven't been doing that. Dark Souls is a huge stretch coming from the guy who coined Marjorie Taylor Brown. Checks out.
It's Marjorie Trader Brown.
I can see how you would forget that.
Right.
Yeah.
Green turns brown. You gotta get the parenthetical too after green turns brown.
Pick one lane. He's trying to shoehorn two ideas into one joke.
Green turns to brown.
He's like, this has layers to it, okay? Filibuster Bluth says, here's hoping Trump's new lawyer best friend finds a similar fate to his previous lawyer best friend, Michael Cohen. Dan from Columbus, trying to be concise for the IM, so I may not articulate this as well as I could, but I think the U.S. government has become a form of elder abuse where staffers and Klingons keep getting their half-brain dead old boss that they're keep telling their half-brain dead old boss that they're doing a great job, so just so the staffers and Klingons can stay and be the real power. Maybe that's conspiratorial sounding. It's absolutely not. I would just add that it's also corporate interests.
Yeah.
It's
the anti-democratic thing. It's easier just to keep rolling the old person out there than to find a new like keeper of the keys that will hold the skeletons in the closet.
So. A new asset. They've already built up so much equity in this fossil. And the staffers, yeah, what makes it worse is that the higher up they are in the pecking order, the more... what's the right word? The better for the resume of the staffer, the more not lucrative. It's just prestige. The more prestige you have as a staffer, so you're even more disincentivized from leaving and moving and working for another office, because keeping like Feinstein in power, or McConnell, if you're a staffer for McConnell, right? Although he's not officially in leadership anymore, but that's how that works. Rama DC says nominating that interview for Best Of, for sure. Majority Report Peace Prize says dementia comes in many forms and can present quite differently. Both Trump and Biden have it, in my opinion.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think Biden's just a couple years ahead of Trump. Trump is going to be this bad in a couple of years if he makes it that long.
Trump's also like a clown, so it's harder to see.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, also Biden has had a lot more like actual health, like adverse health incidents related to his brain in the past that they kind of paper over when they talk about like his, you know, current situation. And like Trump, you know, may or may not have had multiple strokes, but he has a history of this kind of thing in his family. So I think that Biden is just, you know, he's suffered a few more strokes than Trump has.
Yeah. June Oliver says, I've been sleeping on Brandon's channel. There's good shit over there. For sure.
Don't oversell it.
Ryan from Santa Monica, the smoke in the air means you're getting less oxygen with each breath, so your body feeling the deprivation just kind of slows everything down. So now, instead of operating at your normal super genius levels, you are falling closer to a Dave Rubin Tim Pool level. Not that low, but closer. Thank you for explaining to me what's happening in my brain right now. Definitely slow today, for sure, guys.
I want to play real quickly this Pensacola thing. I recently had to delete a tweet because I said some unkind things that were deemed harassment of the bomber planes that flew over New York City on July 4th. I said something harassing about them that I won't repeat here. And
you're
Twitter
a planist?
Said, yeah, Twitter said I had to delete the tweet in order to keep my account open, so I did delete it. And then another flyover happened, and I still feel the way I do about flyovers and the type of people who like them. But it prompted Pete Hegseth to say this: the flyovers will continue until morale improves. Now, what is that a response to for folks who haven't seen it? Well, in Pensacola, the Blue Angels, which people say, oh, the Blue Angels, they should know better than to do this. Well, they didn't. Here is Pensacola, Florida, a bunch of beachgoers and a airplane, the Blue Angels, flying over.
Oh my God!
That's insane.
What?
I mean, there's been incidents where,
yeah,
those planes doing fancy tricks have. I think there's a famous one, specifically where like 70 people,
yep,
died.
Damn,
because a plane crashed into the crowd below them. Yeah,
well,
there's
just
a reason
why
even when they do air shows, the air shows aren't happening directly above people.
Yeah, just a few months ago, like two of those fighter jets collided in one of those air shows, like over a state fair in the Midwest somewhere. And I mean, luckily collided is a strong way to put it, but luckily the two the pilots made their way out of it and like ejected before that, but it happened right over the fair.
Well, obviously the flyer of that plane must have had low T.
Yeah,
we just need more testosterone injected into them, and then they won't be engaging in such reckless behavior. Or is it the reverse? I can't tell.
I think
Hegseth would say that the fighter pilot who did this has very high T, because this is how cool.
Errol Baddix. This is just let me quickly get this the rule for the FAA. Aerobatics 50 feet over crowds is strictly prohibited, as is any flight directly over open air assemblies of people, congested areas, or populated zones. Stunt pilots and military jets are legally restricted from performing maneuvers directly over spectator areas.
But and it looks like most Duffy people taking care of it.
like listen, it's reckless to do that with a crowd who specifically came out to see airplane tricks or whatever. But it looks like these people were just at the beach. Like, they weren't even there to view a plane show, and they were being forced. Like, on top of that, even though nothing did end up happening in this particular incident, they still had to deal with all the ramifications of a plane of that type flying that low. Like, all their stuff went flying. I'm sure people, but you don't know how their hearing is or whatever. Like, yeah. All that stuff, health issues. People, you could have given someone a heart attack if they got nervous.
Blowing
or scared
sand
of
into their lungs.
Yeah.
What about?
Yeah.
I mean, is that good for like soldiers with PTSD? Like, aren't there like veterans with PTSD who might be triggered by?
You think
like
Republicans
that?
Care about soldiers with PTSD? I mean, Trump went on stage and was saying how he likes soldiers that weren't captured, unlike John McCain, who couldn't even raise his arms above a certain level because of all of the broken bones from his torture. Trump had the temerity to say that. Look, I hate John McCain, but damn, you can't take that away from him, honestly. So
it is a real sickness in people's hearts. And I have plenty of people I love who love a good military flyover that happens all the time in North Dakota. We got the Air Force bases up there. I've said before on this show, like when I was going to Minnesota State, the first week of school every semester in the fall, they'd fly the fucking fighter pilots that would fly fighter jets over the Fargo Moorhead area. It's disgusting. It's taunting waste and evil of our country in our fucking face. And I think the people feel like somehow conflicted about it, like, or like, oh, the symbolism of majesty. It's disgusting. It's a sign of depravity that Americans like that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I would say it's also
Go ahead, Brandon. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say it's just also a commercial for the military industrial complex, and one that has led to people being unable to come to grips with the reality that we've lost the war with Iran. And, you know, it's maybe not a direct line from people watching all of these stupid flyovers of B-2 bombers or of like Blue Angels at like sports shows. But it is part of the complex of propaganda that has made it impossible for the American population, and including, I think, a significant number of like the people who represent the media class, to understand like where we are when it comes to this war with Iran, because they've had this like specter of U.S. military might in front of them, parade in front of them for so long. And like now, like, you know, I guess people are just by nature of that contributing to this like mire that we can't get out of, too.
Right.
Which makes all the points you made just honestly makes Hegseth's comment all the more like damning for him and Trump and the administration. Like, I know he's just thinking he's being like funny or whatever, because he's repeating like a commonly used like meme phrase or whatever. But like the idea that you would need to do this to improve, like fly, do these flyovers to improve morale. Why? Is it because like how you guys view patriotism as like the hurrah and loving the military and everything about the, you know, what the military does? The morale around the country is so low because of you guys that you need to do these flyovers to try to force that, like, oh, I can't not like these flyovers, like sort of like feeling from the general public that like,
yeah,
this is supposed to be something that's like hip hip hooray, the military, the American might, like, it, morale's, well, that bad that you got to do these? Wow.
He's interesting. He's in hot water. I was reading an article earlier this morning. It was leaked to CBS, who now obviously has allies in the Trump administration. So it's interesting how upset Trump is with Hegseth, who, shocker, the guy who was reportedly chanting kill all Muslims in a bar and has a Crusades tattoo and spent his career prior to this both as a Fox News host but also as somebody who was lobbying for pardons for convicted war criminals in our military in the Iraq War. Shocker that he apparently was pushing for the most maximalist approach to the Iran war, and Trump's now feeling a little bit burned that Hegseth oversold him on the capacity to topple the Iranian regime by bombing the hell out of them. What a shocker. And once again, I will remind people that on the opening day of our criminal war on Iran, we double-tapped a girls' school and killed over 100 children, and they blamed it on AI. But we now have reporting that showing that they bypassed warnings internally, and I am completely, you know, on the side of the idea that we should not cast aside, and it's naive to cast aside the possibility that Hegseth bombed that girls' school on purpose. These are the people that we're dealing with.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I would also say, like, it seems so long ago now, but there was a time where Pete Hegseth basically once a week, maybe multiple times, was doing those early morning press conferences on Fox News or in front of the podium to kind of shore up and lie about the state of the war. Every week it was, they've been obliterated, they've been decimated, they have nothing left. He would give those very, very grandiose like proclamations aimed entirely at Trump. And for a while, I mean, I guess people were able to believe it, but then they just kind of stopped. And I think that does have to do with, you know, Trump's mood about the war taking a very like sharp downturn and just no longer like appreciating Pete Hegseth's willingness to go on television to tell him these lies.
Let's do 18 here. So Ben Shapiro is losing viewership very quickly and has been for quite a while. It started with Candace Owens's departure, but it's also, I think, really over the fact that he is ideologically a Zionist and there's a large swath of his audience that is more attracted to the commentary on this very topic from Candace Owens or Tucker Carlson because they criticize the state of Israel. And if you're under the age of 40, you are pretty negative about Israel right now, and that crosses across ideology. And so Ben Shapiro, despite being an online creator, is trying to appeal to a much older base of the Republican Party. He just doesn't have the numbers that is going to translate to that. And so he's been making moves to like go on CNN a little bit more. I think he's trying to normalize himself. To get out of this space and expand his audience into
the woke right.
Trying to get away from the woke right.
Right.
But like these politics are not in vogue, and you'll hear it here in his, you know, eulogy for Lindsey Graham, who he calls one of the best senators of all time. And this is his reasoning for it. He tries to bring in some familiar faces into and names.
Show me who hates you. I'll tell you what kind of person you are.
Exactly. Into what his version is of like the axis of evil, kind of, that is opposing Israel. And also he throws in Ukraine there as if he cares about that at all. But here is Ben Shapiro talking about Lindsey Graham's death.
We can judge a man by his enemies. You know who was happy when Lindsey Graham died? Iran was very happy. Russia was very happy. You know who else was really, really happy? The echo chamber of evil. So who is that echo chamber of evil? Well, the dirtbag left and the two online right. They hug each other. They help each other. They maximize each other. They collab on destroying America.
Can you pause it?
So what you have here is...
You're also online. And what you're bitching about and bringing your personal grievances into this... is about you not being able to get any traction online, which is like your whole medium. Oh. Your whole thing was the Daily Wire was a conservative alternative to Fox News for the online audience. Go ahead, Brandon.
No, I was going to say that clip reminded me of the other thing, you know, that is leading to Ben Shapiro's like lack of success in the modern internet landscape is that his content's also not very good. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten a lot worse as he started to become less popular. I can't say how popular he has ever been based on like how his numbers are seemingly juiced now and like very evidently juiced now on some of his clips. But like when you watch the videos now, there's such a palpable level of, I don't know, like resentment for his own lack of success, especially with the failure of these, you know, more fiction based products like the Bent Key Productions and that stupid
whatever, you know,
the Pendragon Chronicles, Pendragon, or whatever it's called. Yeah,
which bankrupted the Daily Wire, basically, or bankrupted it, right. But it destroyed it. The Pendragon cycle. It was like the production that Jeremy Boring got behind.
No, but that's the thing, though. Like, this, it's not like he's coming from a position of, like, you know, we tried to fight these more powerful forces and we failed. No, they literally succeeded. They were the biggest online conservative outlet. I'm saying this to someone who thinks they're horrible, but just strictly by numbers and attention and views, they were the biggest for a time. They were the biggest online conservative outlet there was. They succeeded in the project that they claimed they wanted to do politically. But that wasn't enough for them. they needed that adoration from like the mainstream audience to create and fulfill their own dreams of becoming like Hollywood stars and producers and screenwriters and whatever. And that is ultimately what led them, one of the things that led them down this path where they've lost money and honestly credibility with a lot of people who were into what they were doing before.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, honestly, I think that's just because, you know, all Republicans have that one thing in common, and that's like grievance and victim complex drama that drives them to be like conservative. And for them, it was not getting ingratiated in Hollywood the way that they feel like they should. But I would also say, I wonder how popular they ever really were organically. There's been such a concerted effort by like not just billionaire money to prop these people up, but legacy media outlets to tell us how popular they actually are, that their lack of numbers, so much of it is just seems to be downstream from a lack of money now, just like a lack of the kind of money pouring in that, you know, used to be pouring in.
They were buying views. I want to get back to the clip just because I interrupted and we start, but let's just start from the beginning and we'll get fuller context and then we'll open it back up, guys. Apologies.
Iran was very happy. Russia was very happy. You know who else was really, really happy? The echo chamber of evil. So who is that echo chamber of evil? Well, the dirtbag left and the two online right. They hug each other. They help each other. They maximize each other. They collab on destroying America. So what you have here is a closed loop, an echo chamber, where the same dozen people cycle through each other's shows saying the same poisonous things, trying to maximize everybody's exposure. Cenk Uygur has a show with Anna Kasparian. That's Hassan Piker's uncle. That's where Hassan got his start. Candace Owens has Tucker on. Tucker platforms Nick Fuentes and Cenk and Anna. Cenk endorses Tucker. Hassan nods along.
Wait, can you pause
with
it?
The same lines that
he just mispronounces Cenk's name and then said it correctly there. He's doing the Mamdani thing where they're trying to delegitimize Cenk by mispronouncing his name. And it's interesting to me because Anna and Ben used to be quite friendly, but I guess they fell out over Israel.
But he's getting mad. He's getting mad over the same thing that Daily Caller does. Like, you literally had Candace Owens on your network. Like, she was a host on the Daily Caller network. And she,
Daily
from
Wire.
The very beginning, Daily Wire, I'm sorry, the Daily Wire network. And you knew from when you hire her that she wasn't 100% lock in step with you guys. Like, maybe whatever that other guy is with the K, Clav, whatever his name is. Also, the same way you get in Matt Walsh, who... you know, maybe you guys agree on some things, but he's definitely in different areas than Ben Shapiro on others. Like, you did the same thing. The only problem you're getting mad about is that you're no longer, I guess, leading the charge about it.
Yep, exactly right. He used to be having, you know, doing podcasts with Anna at the very least, and now he's mad that they're on to Tucker's. Like, that is what he's upset about, which is hilarious to me, but keep going.
Hassan nods along with the same lines that Nick Fuentes is posting. They're all pretending to be opponents, but they're not. They all hate the country together. Because here's the thing.
Which country?
If you are left to judge, who loved the country more? The senator who spent 33 years in the United States military, spanning the active duty Air Force, South Carolina Air National Guard, and the Air Force Reserve. The senator who stood for American peace through strength and stood staunchly alongside our allies like Ukraine and Israel against Russia and Iran. The senator who never made a penny off his office, unlike pseudo-socialists like, say, Congressman Ro Khanna, worth $250 million. Or alternatively, the influencer class who thrill to terrorists and dictators and openly celebrate that senator's death. I'll pick Senator Lindsey Graham every single time. If these are the people who celebrated Lindsey Graham's death the most, then hell, Lindsey Graham may be one of the best senators of all time. Again, Lindsey Graham stood for American strength. These jacks stand for American weakness, surrender, and collapse. They think America is a nefarious force abroad, that America's allies are the problem, that terrorists are basically Israel. Just freedom fighters against American and West.
Ooh, America's allies, Ben. I mean, do we need more?
I mean, a child, yeah. But I do think it's funny how he shoehorned his extremely personal grievances into the Lindsey Graham obituary. How long did he get into his complaining about Nick Fuentes and Tucker Carlson collaborating, or Cenk and Tucker Carlson collaborating, until he got back to the issue at hand, which was Lindsey Graham.
Who's not about peace through strength, whatever the fuck that means. He's peace through war, because yes. he supports wars.
Right, and he keeps... And
war
he talks,
through war.
Notice how he talks... He mentions the dirtbag left, and then also the right, but he's not mentioning anybody who's actually on the left right now.
Honestly, like, his show is just so bad. I honestly just tuned him out. Like, yeah. And I think a lot of people are just getting to that point. Like, his...
It's just grievance now that he's not Mr. Popular anymore. Yep. He's not the face of the online conservative right or whatever. Like, he's just, it's just him getting angry at the world that he's not the leading man anymore. I think it's funny what he said about Lindsey Graham. Like, if you look at various Daily Wire hosts, I just typed in Matt Walsh, Lindsey Graham. His last video on Lindsey Graham was a few months ago. Effeminate neocon Lindsey Graham proves his insanity once again on air. Like, give me a break. These guys are so... Ben Shapiro in particular is so disingenuous. Give me a break.
Yep. June Oliver said, did Ben Shapiro just mute the word ass? Because I distinctly remember hearing about a wet ass P word. I do. I'm not sure what you're referring to. But Josh in California, peace through strength is just rebranding war as peace. Yes. JR in Philly, Brandon, congrats on your collab with the Majority Report.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Big things.
As a socialist accountant, I'm a bit of an aviation enthusiast, but flyovers like this are reckless. Even flying a Cessna prop plane that low is dangerous, yet these fighter jets are practically missiles. Autistic Mandalorian says, I grew up next to a naval base that has an annual air show. Still live close enough to get daily flyovers for about a week before. Really not looking forward to October if the Blue Angels pilots are going to be pulling this shit over my house. Catlec, I guess one positive thing about Pete Hegseth being appointed to Secretary of Defense and that job being redefined to boss of the military is that the American military will never, ever recover no matter how much money gets thrown at it. That's a good theory.
We should use this moment to reconsider how much of money we've just completely wasted for war purposes.
Yep. Do we have anything we want to get to really quickly? We should just, should we talk, this Nolan Wells story, I've been struggling with an angle to cover it, but I feel like we should cover it. Let me think for a second.
We have a guest on tomorrow who's been following it.
Yeah,
conversation tomorrow too.
We'll talk about it tomorrow. It's just like, it's horrible. It's horrible. And it seems like this kid was killed and like they erased his phone is what the parents are claiming. And then Ben Crump is getting involved now and is their attorney. And they're finally looking into this down in Mississippi. But yeah, we'll talk about it a bit tomorrow. Just too long to get into right here. Let's do this really quickly. This is an interesting discussion on Morning Joe on MS Now. This is Mara Gray, who used to be, I believe, at the Wall Street Journal and is now at the New York Times. And just notice her tone in this conversation, because she's at the right position where that we all share about Israel's genocide in Gaza, but you. With the fact that she's at these, you know, elite papers, you can tell how she has to moderate herself in rooms like this, because Zionism is an ideology that crosses religion, but is disproportionately shared by members of our elite class. How she's just saying simple facts to, next to this man who is seething, Donny Deutsch. I don't know much about him, except he's a rich guy that
he inherited his dad's advertising firm.
Well, he's a Zionist, and he gets super pissed off as she says things clearly here, explaining why people in this country are concerned about their taxpayer money going to Israel and how voters are responding to this as an issue in elections. So she does a great job here, but I feel badly for her, because you can see how, like, while normal people are speaking about this in plain language, this is the kind of stuff that someone like her, and particularly as a woman of color, has to navigate in these media institutions. Because he's so aggressive, as she's saying, just plain facts.
Yeah, responding to a Nepo baby.
Yep, marketer. Exactly.
I was at the election night party for one of the DSA candidates in New York, Claire Valdez. And the first chant that crowd had when they won was actually tax the rich. And so, you know what? I hear you. I just want to go to Joe's point that this is about cost. One of the things that I see when I talk to voters that's happening is everyday voters are connecting the fact that they're.
I just want to get what he said, that when he says, I hope it is here, what he's implying is that it's actually about anti-Semitism.
Yep.
I mean.
Us, I think.
I hope
one
it
of,
is.
One of, but one
he
of
also
the things
hope it
that,
is that I
yeah. Right. Yeah.
And he won't accept that it is. He will. There's no way he'll ever accept that it is just that.
Yep.
I talk to voters. That's happening is everyday voters are connecting the fact that their tax dollars are going to spend, they're spending millions of tax dollars, billions of dollars on bombing civilians in a foreign country. And that's what makes Israel different for so many voters. It's what Joe said at the beginning of this conversation, that it's their tax dollars. So they feel that this is personal for them. That doesn't mean that anti-Semitism isn't also
let me ask
a factor.
If the bombing stopped and all of a sudden everything stopped, do you think this anti-Semitism would stop?
No, because anti-Semitism is the oldest hate that we have, and it is a scourge, and it is sadly always going to be there until we can find a way to be better humans. And I think it's a constant issue. That doesn't mean that Americans don't have a right to be enraged that their tax dollars are going to fund what many people, including myself, view as genocide.
It's not a genocide. A genocide, so let's get this straight. God, there are as many Gazans alive today as when this war started. It is not a genocide.
Pause
it's
it.
It's just not. We
okay.
Can...
So for also, I misspoke, and it's Mara Gay. It's not Mara Gray. Don't worry. That would be a Holocaust. what he's talking about, that is not the definition of genocide. The definition of genocide has legal consequences, and it has benchmarks, which Israel has far exceeded. We don't need to get into the definition. I could rattle off the five planks of what constitutes a genocide, and you only need one under the UN definition to constitute a genocide. Israel has crossed the threshold for all five. We know this to be the truth. B'Tselem, Israeli human rights group, says it's a genocide. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, any credible organization says it's a genocide. But the fact that he's now moved the goalpost to essentially saying it can only be a genocide if they exterminate the entire population gives you a sense of the depravity of a Zionist like this.
And I would just like to revise one of her answers there the aggressive asking by Deutsch, again, a guy who inherited his dad's advertising firm. That's why anyone knows who he is. When he says, if all of this ended, what do you mean? The occupation of Palestine? Like, what,
right.
What he means, would all this end?
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean, would all this end? Because I'll tell you what, if Israel wasn't occupying Palestine and hadn't been, and the Nakba never happened, and the massive displacement of Palestinians leading to a refugee crisis that we still deal with to this day, if all that was remedied, yes, anti-Semitism would be significantly less than it is right now.
Yep.
It's the number one driver, is Israel, is the number one driver of anti-Semitism in our modern context now. That's not only in America, that's even in the Middle East. Because the thing that's unspoken when they talk about, look at all these Jews that had to flee these other countries after Israel formed. Yeah, after Israel was formed. Because this nationalism, this idea of Zionism has fucked the world up.
And attributing Israel's actions to Jews more broadly has driven anti-Semitism. When you repeatedly call yourself the Jewish state and then commit atrocities, then you wonder why certain people who don't have a sufficient political education say Jews are responsible for X, Y, and Z. Like, yeah, that's what's going to happen. So Israel has to change course to reduce anti-Semitic sentiment, but he's refusing to acknowledge that is the path that things have to go down. And what that means is when this all ends, you do have to ask the question, what does it mean in terms of ending for him?
Yep. Because
the expulsion of Palestinians fully, or what he talks about, which is essentially the extermination of Palestinians, which I don't know if he'd say this in polite society, but he seems to think that's preferable to Israel becoming not fully Jewish in character and including Palestinians as full human, people with civil and political rights.
No, he just means exactly what it was like before October 7th or something. Yep. That's what he's talking about. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We can't go back to that reality. I mean, obviously.
But even prior to October 7th, there wasn't all this goes away. That we weren't in a scenario where there wasn't things happening or had happened or ongoing were happening, you know? Like,
indeed, genocide.
Yeah.
Thousands of lives today is when this war started. It is not a genocide. It's just not. We'll agree to disagree on it.
We're going to agree to disagree on it. But I can tell you that the uprising in the Democratic Party is about an anger that the Democratic establishment is weak and has failed to stop Trump. And has failed to make the everyday lives of Americans better. And if you look at the actual policies that are supported by many of the folks that people here would consider far left and also just progressives in general, you know, and I'm not talking about the most extreme policies like prison abolition, which is not universal on the left or anything, but talking about the heart of that agenda is actually increasingly popular with the American public.
It's income inequality.
It's Medicare for all. Disentangling politics from corporate interests, by the way, which is a huge factor for a lot of people in both parties, not just Democrats. And it's spending more money for Americans here and stopping campaigns abroad, not only in Israel, but people are also very angry over Iran. So it's not only Israel.
I have not heard the poor people of Iran, the people who've gotten decimated and killed. I don't hear the same level of fury and passion.
I also have to say that
sorry, maybe you aren't listening. People bring up people are very upset about the Iran war. What the fuck is he talking about?
I don't know. But also, we haven't been waging a war in Iran like we have been waging this genocide in Gaza for 2.5+ years at this point. So.
Still quite a lot of outrage about, like, say, the Manab girls' school being bombed on day one. Like, I mean, that's a good question for Morning Joe. Because Donnie Deutsch was kicked off of this network because he went at Keith Olbermann, 14 years ago, saying we need more purple voices and some of these guys are planting too much anger. Why the fuck is he back? Why do these people get invited to these studios? He is an advertiser.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Why? I never got why he's on Morning Joe all the time. Why
and we got the Shark Tank legend from Canada, that dumbass that's Kevin in that O'Leary. Movie. Kevin O'Leary. Yeah. Why?
Well, Mara Gay is an actual reporter, and he's lecturing to her in this, extremely entitled manner. Even Joe Scarborough interjects and is like, what are you talking? I mean, he's both trying to bolster her point about how it's about incoming wealth inequality. People get it. People who are ideological Zionist zealots are delusional. They're deluded, and they're not connected to reality.
Right. That's the thing. That's the perfect, way to describe this. You have on one end someone who's using the lived experience of not just themselves and their own opinion, but the experience that they've gotten from others who've spoken to them. They've looking at the facts, what organizations have looked into, the research. And then on the other side, you got someone going, I don't think so. No, my opinion's different.
Yeah, TV personality has a different opinion. Okay, what the fuck do I care?
Right.
I mean, listen, he's welcome to his opinion, but his opinion just doesn't line up with the facts of where not just the Democratic Party base, but the vast majority of Americans are. I mean, he's welcome to his opinion, but it's not the same opinion as most people.
And why is it relevant to be broadcast?
Exactly.
Very angry over Iran. So it's not only Israel.
I have not heard the poor people of Iran, the people who've gotten decimated and killed. I don't hear the same level of fury and passion.
I also have to say that one interesting race to consider in New York was the race between Brad Lander and Dan Goldman, two Jewish men, Democrats, both I know personally, both really good public servants.
Yeah, Dan Goldman wouldn't call it a genocide. It hurt. Like that was the entry ticket. You have to call it a genocide, otherwise we can't elect you. Brad Lander just
there are election. That district where I live has a significant number of Jewish voters, and many of those voters voted for Brad Lander, others voted for Dan Goldman, and so. I just, this is not only about anti-Semitism. Yes. This goes beyond anti-Semitism. Yeah. This is about how American tax dollars are being spent.
Like, the level of aggression that he has towards her is really crazy. And I, you know, she's trying so hard not to offend him. And the fact that this is, like, really the kind of stuff that people are navigating, and it's why the elite, or, like, the elite conversation about this, where, like, in New York, like, I mean, I am saying, of course, Zionism is an ideology that's shared by largely white people, but it's both Jewish and there are Christian Zionists as well. So I'm not trying to say this is because of Jewish people. I'm trying to say that in, like, wealthier circles, Zionism is an ideology that is overrepresented. And she's just trying to say the facts of what she saw attending that Claire Valdez party and what people were motivated by. And he can't even emotionally handle it and is trying to shut her down.
I apologize for saying this isn't a credible man in Donny Deutsch. Let me just read from Zookapedia. He's published 7 books, including a business motivation book called Often Wrong, Never in Doubt, Unleash the Business Rebel Within.
Yeah.
Book received mixed reviews. And one saying in the chapter, it all comes back to babes. It has the quote, "I'm not going to fuck somebody for business, ... unless she's really hot. Why not? I'd fuck her if we weren't doing business." So there we go. Donny Deutsch, welcome to MSNBC, MS Now Studios, for your brilliant insight into all this shit.
Right, exactly. I mean, if he just wasn't there, the facts of what she saw at the Valdez party could have been communicated to the audience without this insane indignance.
It's like an old man watching his TV, except he's there on set.
Yep. Oh, there's Brandon.
Like that. Yeah, that's a good one.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like. I just don't get why he's there.
Yep.
Yeah, that's
it's so weird, you know, to look at these news programs, particularly the cable. But I imagine the network news, like Sunday shows, do this too. But like the CNN, like how do you book these shows? Like these are charlatans.
Listen, if he was on like as like a one-off every like now and then, it'd be like, still, like, why is he on? But like, okay, maybe they want to throw out some people from like offbeat areas to get different voices. This guy's like a regular on the show. He's taking up a spot on a daily basis from someone who is way more informed and has better analysis. It's just bizarre.
I mean, imagine if like in Mad Men, like Don Draper's like going to talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis on TV. It's like, you're an advertiser. What are you doing here?
Right, right.
Well, I mean, you have to understand. Well, I mean, in their defense, you have to understand that a significant portion of Americans, how many I don't know, but a significant portion are psychopaths. So if you don't have like psychopath representation on the panel, a lot of people are going to feel alienated. You gotta have at least one person on the panel.
It's
just like we gotta do a genocide, right? We just gotta like kill a bunch of people. Because like if you don't, like, you know. A lot of Americans will just tune out. They won't understand what's happening. That's a really important part of the conversation.
You're right. All right, guys, I'm going to read some IMs and then we'll get out of here. Number 13, dude is on the show because he is paid to be, hence the problem with the system. The rich do whatever they want and go wherever they want. The concentration of influence has made them delusional.
There's other richer people.
Yeah. Maybe he's just, I would guess he's just like friends.
They just
Joe.
Like him. Yeah, it's embarrassing.
JR in Philly, the Lander Goldman race shows this is not beyond anti-Semitism. It has nothing to do with anti-Semitism whatsoever. Yes. And that district, which is also my district, like, there, I don't know if there is a district that has a higher proportion of Jewish people in the country. I mean, we would have to look that up, but it's pretty significant.
I mean, Upper East Side.
Or Borough Park.
Upper East Side, probably. I mean, it's definitely not a very Zionist Jewish population, though. You see way more Free Palestine stuff here. Whereas you will, like, you go on the Upper East Side, you'll see, like, Zionist stuff.
That's exactly a great... The Upper East Side, the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to be Zionist. Like, the Park Slope area here in Brooklyn, which has a large Jewish population, like, Park Slope Co-op just voted to divest.
Yep.
So, I mean, people need to stop doing this.
I think you see that across a lot of, honestly, like diaspora groups who have this kind of issue going on. Like the rich areas of London that I'm around sometimes for a while, a lot of Persian monarchist flags, right? Like this, like support of the military industrial complex and the unending war, you know, it plays out like across like class lines, I think, very acutely.
Yep. 5 more and then we'll get out of here. Cricket Gnomes Revenge said, "I get instantly distracted by the angry caterpillars on his forehead. I'm afraid they're going to eat his head."
About no.
Oh, Ben, oh, Ben Shapiro. Shapiro. Yeah.
I do think we did land on that. The video we watched was a little bit, or the image we saw was a little bit augmented, but it's within like reality.
Yeah, yeah, and that's some fake news. I don't really care about spreading Ben Shapiro's eyebrows being big. The propaganda value of that is too great. Evan from Portland, if Iran was occupied for decades and their people were being killed all the time, we would have the same response as Palestine. Yep. California resistance, tick, tick, little by little, the old worn out and sold out members of Congress will fade away or die, tick, tick. Jill Migolo says, saying Park Slope isn't rich is the most out-of-touch thing Emma has ever said. Okay, I never said it's not rich.
Relative to the Upper East Side.
Relative to the Upper East Side. And the final I am of the day. Gulf Coast Grit. That school was 100% bombed on purpose. The key giveaway is the double, triple tap strike. The school had a lot of military officers' children going there. They hit it the first time to draw the parents to the school to get their kids, then hit it again to kill them.
Yep.
It age timing gives away the game. If you're trying to smash a target while using follow-up strikes for a BDA, the hits are much closer together. If I recall, that there was 20 or 30 minutes between missiles. And that would be a tactic also that, like, the Israeli government would use, by the way. So, like, drawing, I mean, people out of their homes and using their children to get, you know, the adults that they want to get to, or whatever. Go ahead,
it's also
Brandon.
A terrible tactic. I'm just going to, you know, speak to, like, how it's antithetical to wanting the war to be resolved in some kind of real, I think, you know, right after that strike way, because ultimately it was only going to animate the people, right? There, I think, is this belief that we can murder people around the world without any consequences and they'll just like smile and take it and be glad to like bend over backwards to sign a deal with us. And I mean, if you were thinking about it in any like reasonable, if you like were able to humanize these people a little bit better than I think even people within our military industrial complex and deep state are able to, you know, they would have understood like why martyring the 84-year-old, I can't remember how old the Supreme Leader was, the old one. And then like killing a bunch of like schoolgirls on the first day would probably not be the way to ensure that the war had a resolution as diplomatic as they're trying to look for one now.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks so much. Appreciate you all. Thanks, Binder, Brandon, Matt, and Brian. We will see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the